Hey folks, Tyler from Being This Person here, and welcome back. Welcome to 2021. Off the top, I have mentioned, or maybe you don't know if you aren't following on social media, it has been very difficult through 2020 getting guests because, frankly, we can't go anywhere or see anyone in person. And so at the end of the year, I kind of took a break to reassess my situation. And the way I'm going to do it going forward, at least for the time being, until the world changes to something more like the way it used to be, is I'm just going to release these when I get them. I've got a couple in my pocket, so there will be a couple that come out every other week, but after that, it's going to be whenever I can get guests and sit down and find a way to chat, be it via the internet, like you've been hearing recently, or maybe, you know, hopefully we can sit in a room together again sometime soon. But just so that you know, the frequency is going to drop off a bit. It's just the way of what it is right now. So thank you for supporting me. I will still be out here. I'm not quitting everything altogether, but there is going to be some change in timing. So that all being said, I figured I'd welcome you all back with a super long one. Well, not a super long one. It's almost 2 hours, but it's with the wonderful Gene, whom all of you met before in his first episode. And Gene is just the sweetest person, and we have the best time talking, and we get all kinds of off-topic, and that's what it's about. I think you'll really enjoy the conversation. He and I certainly did, and we talked about an hour or so before the recording and an hour or so or more after the conversation or recorded conversation, and it was just marvelous. I love catching up with Gene. Always got a story, that one. But So at this point, folks, I would encourage you to subscribe and leave good ratings and reviews on whatever podcast feed you get us through. It is free for you. It does help us with exposure, which we could use some more of. I also, if you'd like to contact me, have an email. It is beingthisperson@gmail.com. Pretty easy. We're also on Facebook, Being This Person, and I have a website, beingthisperson.com, where you can find some of the older episodes because there's enough now that they're starting to drop off the feed a little bit. I also have a personal Twitter if you'd like to keep up in the interim when there aren't episodes coming out. It is at Donis Tyler, so DonesTyler. I don't throw a ton of stuff up there, especially right now with the political climate, but I do occasionally retweet or have a thought that I think is kind of fun or share a picture of what's going on in my world, but it's something you can follow along with and still hold that connection. On the note of the Patreon is still there. At this point in time, if this schedule thing continues to be intermittent, I may drop it off. I may not. I don't know. But at this point in time, you can go to Patreon, patreon.com/beingthisperson. And for $1 a month donation, I will give you a personalized thank you note. I have been kind of remiss in some of the upper tier stuff. So for whatever that's worth, It is a way to help support the cost of the show because whether I do it every week or not, it still costs me money every year. I think that's enough of my background stuff, and we should probably get on to this. So thank you so much for listening. I appreciate you. I hope you health and happiness in this new year. Let's roll the theme music. Welcome back. And the first question is, just like the last time, who are you?
I'm Gene from Salem. I'm a crazy drag queen and a non-adulting adult. And yeah, just surviving quarantine and trying to be fabulous.
But doing an excellent job of it, both of them. I mean, you're still alive and you're fabulous.
Hey, you know, above ground and breathing.
Right? There's a lot to be said for that. So we did drag queen a bit last time, but so let's get into the just kind of the shit of the world right now. Like, what's surviving quarantine like? I know we're talking a little bit off recording about it, but what's surviving quarantine like?
Well, I found that I'm really kind of a bit of a introvert. I didn't realize this before, but yeah, the longer I would stay at home, like the first 3 weeks of the whole like lockdown thing, I didn't leave the house. Like, I didn't leave my apartment. I didn't even go and check my mail. Like, if I did, it was like midnight when I knew nobody'd be around. I'd put the mask on and the hood up and gloves and go check the mail and come back and strip everything off on the porch and come inside. I was insane over the top about the whole safety thing. And I'm still like super, super clean, and I change masks all the time because I make so many masks. I think I'm going to keep masking even after this is all over, because I just really like the fact that I look good every day, because all I have to do is make sure that my eyes like don't have any goobers in them. And everybody's like, you look really good today. I'm like, thank you. I know. Right about that. But no, I didn't leave the house. And then when I did, I was like so freaked out that I was leaving the house. And I find that I really like the longer I'm in my apartment, the more I don't want to leave my apartment.
Yeah.
But I also net. So then it turns even more into a hoarder home, because then I put everything around me that I need in the one space that I'm going to sit. And at one point I had like the computer desk and the love seat. And then I had a card table set up in front of the love seat by the computer desk and a little sewing machine. And I like moved another table over. I had like a whole little like cubicle of just nothing but arts and crafts going on. Like 3 crafts at one time, painting a doll, sewing masks, you know, working on a gown. Yeah. And eating everything in sight.
Oh, yeah. I definitely went through that phase, too. Like, if it wasn't nailed down for the first couple of weeks. Like, and I never actually totally quit working. I mean, until I quit my job, and then I took a little bit of time off, but now I have a job again. But even then, like, I was in my house so much. Anything that I could touch and stuff in my face for some reason, it was go.
I used to have like, I have a big drawer in my kitchen that's always been full of rice and pasta. Always. It's always had too much rice and pasta in it. Like, friends would be like, oh gosh, I'm short this month on food. And I'm like, do you need rice and pasta? Because I can give you about 20 pounds of pasta and a bunch of rice. And always rice and pasta. I had to go and buy pasta for the first time like last month because I ate through my supply of rice and pasta. I learned that you can pour anything over rice and it's delicious. Barbecue sauce, teriyaki sauce, ketchup. Like, it was like
you had me until ketchup, but yeah. But that's what rice is good for. I mean, that's why it's such a staple in so many parts of the world. It's easy, it's cheap.
Butter and the popcorn shaking toppings, the Parmesan popcorn shaker stuff. That was some like butter or like whatever like wet creamy thing you could find. And
oh, well, and my grandmother used to do something they called lye spry, which is essentially a sweet rice. So she'd cook it in milk instead of water.
Oh.
Yeah, and so it comes up kind of...
It sounds almost like rice pudding.
Yeah, kind of a rice pudding, kind of an oatmeal-y, kind of something like that. And you put a little honey or sugar or something on it. It was you know, from the old country. But
it sounds
really
delicious.
Good. Yeah, really good, and cost like what? 19 cents or something.
Oh yes, that'd be super cheap. I watched this woman make she took like 2 packs of ramen and just other shit in her kitchen and made like a hamburger helpery type meal for like 6 people with like 2 packs of ramen and just like other findings from the kitchen, pretty much, like just staples that you always have. And I was like, wow, that's cool. Like, made me want to go buy ramen, except for I hate that shit.
Do you hate it because you had to live on it for so many years, like all the rest of us?
Yep.
Yep.
That was college. Like, that would go into school in Portland. That was what I did. Like, I lived on minute rice and salsa and top ramen.
Yep. We all did. I still kind of have a soft spot, and we'll still make some once in a while, generally late at night when I'm not of all of my facilities. But
well, Double D taught me how to take ramen and make it gourmet. Like, if you got vegetables, you throw those in with it. And
yep. I keep shrimp in the freezer. Perfect. Quick, easy thing to add in. Yep.
My freezer is just full of like frozen French fries, frozen naan, and like a whole bunch of like those little mini corn dog bites.
Oh, really?
I found a lead for those at like 3 a.m. I plug in the deep fryer and I'll drink a can of water and then I'll like throw a whole bunch in the basket. I mean, by the basket anymore. I just throw them in and then take the scoop and scoop them up when they float. And yeah. Nothing like 3 a.m. and like nothing but my underwear standing in my kitchen with just the hood light on, like just eating scalding hot fryer foods.
Just dripping in grease and guilt.
Yep. Oh, there's no guilt. I have no guilt anymore.
Well, not at 3 a.m. either, because 3 a.m. you're getting back from a show generally, right?
Anymore. Now that all the bars close at 10, I started performing again like 3 months ago. And now the bars have to close at 10. We started our shows early and they go a lot quicker. So I'm like out by 10. And so I'm home by like 10:30 and eating my naked in the living room with my makeup wipes, eating Taco Bell. And then I come to bed and crash.
So what is performing like now? Because, I mean,
it's weird.
Yeah, because there's barely any performance. You're at least generally one person on a stage, which keeps you distant from anybody in the place. So at least.
But if you want to take tips, then you're close to them.
Right.
We use all the entertainers wear shields. We all wear like face shields.
So you spend 4 hours on your makeup to put a face shield on.
You see through the shield.
Right, but still, like, ring around the forehead much or something?
Oh, no, these are, like, the ones that we all bought are glasses. They're, like, frames for eyeglasses.
Really?
They just have, like, they have a nose loop on each side, and they come up, and there's, like, a band at the top, and then the arm pieces, and then the plastic visor part clips on the outside of that on each side, so it creates a barrier between us, and then it doesn't have the weird band in there to rub against your forehead.
Okay.
It's a little complicated with, like, hairstyles, I found out. Like, it didn't really, it wasn't really easy when I wore my clown wig for the last show. Because I did Miss Tickles at the last show.
And, oh, did you? She's still there.
freaked the audience out. Like, 3/4 of the audience were terrified of me. The moment I started walking on the stage, and I did this song called That Laughing Track. And if you ever get a chance, look it up, because it's the most bizarre song in the world. It's got a great techno dance beat, type house techno dance beat, but it's all laughing. There's no lyrics to it. It's all like, ha, 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 ho, 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 ha, 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 ha.
Oh. I don't know if I could take it.
Like, fucked up clown, like automated clown thing, you know? People were so scared to be.
That I gotta say, that would throw even me for a loop. That just sounds eerie.
It was beautiful. It was so pretty, so beautiful.
Well, I mean, that's
a Halloween show.
Well, that's part of what the art is to create this magical effect on stage. And if you do this in this with this very off the beat soundtrack, and then you in all your splendor, it's gonna be a piece of art.
Oh, I had people that were like coming up to me after the show and like, that's the scariest shit I've ever seen. And I'm like, good, I did my job. They're like, oh yeah, I hate clowns. I love when people say they don't like clowns. So I'm like, but you like drag queens. Well, yeah. I'm like, you know, we're clowns.
Well, you're just clowns.
They're like, what? And I'm like, too much makeup, big hair, big shoes, bright colors. What drag queen isn't a clown? They're like, oh my gosh, you might be right. No, I know I'm right. We're all clowns. Big shoes, big hair, too much makeup.
That's as soon as you started saying it, it was easy for me to kick right into that space, but it is not something that had crossed my mind until you started saying it. But you're right. Like, it is totally just clown. It's crazy costume. Like you said, bright colors, funky shoes, tons of makeup. Like, with your makeup, I can see Gene when I look at Alana, but I have to look for Gene. Like, you're in there. I can see you, but you put on such an amazing illusion that it's hard.
Yeah. But, you know, with the performing, that's been the challenge. Like, well, and all the oh my God, work, the sanitation. Like, we always kept a clean salon, like, because I was the salon cleaner. So, you know, I know how clean the salon was. It was very clean before. But now we have high level in spray bottles. So we hose everything down after each client. Like, the client leaves, we take them out of the shampoo bowl if we have to use the shampoo bowl, and we hose the shampoo bowl down and wipe it down. When we leave our chair, we're hosing the chair, hosing the station, anything they might have touched, anything we touched, washing our hands, changing the masks out. Like, I made masks that are just like, I have a stack of like 30 masks that are just for work because I change out between every client.
Between clients? And then take them home and launder them or something, I imagine?
Next one, they bring them home and launder them and bring them back. I launder them with my money.
I don't know that we didn't record that, but yeah, like literally with the money that you throw in the laundry, that's pretty funny. Change too?
Yeah, it's been an adventure. And it's like the new world order, I think. I think it's just going to be around for a while. We're going to be wearing masks and extra sanitization, because there are people that can't remember to wash their hands or cover their nose. That's like my biggest peeve is that people walk around with the mask here, and like, you know, it's not working if it isn't covering your nose. Like,
I know.
And they still allegory.
They still let them in buildings. I don't get it. Not until you figure this out.
I'm so impressed with Salem because like most of the businesses I go into, or like stores and stuff that I have to go into, I've watched people like at the door be like, "Excuse me, ma'am, sir, you have to put your mask on." "Oh, I have it." "No, you have to put it on before you can come in." All the way on. The buses here are running for free, but all the bus drivers check everybody when they walk in the back door.
Yeah.
And they look at them because they'll be like, sir, in the such and such coat, put your mask on, please, or exit the bus. And I'm like, yes, bitch, put your mask on. It's not that hard. People tell me, like, I've had people tell me that they forgot masks. Clients have come to me and come to the salon and been like, "I forgot my mask." I'm like, "Well, I got a temporary one you can use. Like, I've got a disposable one right here."
Yep.
And they're like, "Oh." I'm like, "And how could you forget your mask? We've been wearing masks now for 6 months.
Well,
how do you forget your mask?
You're going to go spend an hour in close contact with a person while they do your hair and such. How can you not? I mean, like, I've been at my job, we keep a box of disposable masks by the door just for any random yokel that wanders in. Here you go.
Yeah.
Put this on."
Yeah, I do it for every color client I have. I give them a disposable mask because I'm like, I don't want their nice mask to get color on it or anything. So
I'm that's like, a good call.
Take your nice mask off, put this one on. My thing is like, I love giving people a story of pee. People that are like, "Oh, masks, I can't breathe. They're so awful. They're so useless." I'm like, "So let me tell you a little story about pee." And they're like, "Oh." And I'm like, "Yeah. So you're walking down the street, a guy comes up and pees all over you. Just pees all over you. From I'm talking from my nipples down, pees on you. But you're wearing clothes. You can take those off. You get what, maybe 3%, 5% pee on you? That's not that much. You can just take it off. You can wash your body. You're good. Now you're naked and you're walking down the street, and a guy comes up and pees on you, you're getting 100% pee on you. This is my pants and clothing to stop the pee."
Yeah.
And they're like, one lady, I told it to, old lady, she goes, "Oh my God, you're right. That makes perfect sense. Why? I'm never going to try and get out of wearing a mask now because I want people peeing on me." She went back and told her like church, like Bible study group, the story of pee. And all the ladies now wear their masks everywhere.
Well, it's
old women react well to allegories.
Yeah, it's an excellent demonstration of what the situation is. You know, then I use what they, because I tend to run into the more masculine root kind of guys. Like, it doesn't work. Okay, just do this for me. Take one hand, put it over your face. Now spit on me. Could you do it? No. See? Like, this is such an easy concept here, buddy. That's what it is.
I thought so many people are selfish. Like, so many people are selfish in the world, especially this last regime thing. But so they're like, every media outlet was going at it as, you're protecting others. You're protecting others. When I started telling people that were like really anti-mask, I'm like telling them you're protecting yourself. They started wearing masks. Like, because I don't use the pee scenario as like, you're protecting the other person that's peeing on you from getting pee on them. No, no, the selfish thing for masks. It's like, be selfish. Wear your mask.
Yeah.
You don't want them to get you. They're doing their germs on you.
Or to take them home to your loved ones. You know?
It's like really the same direction it's going. So you're like, it works both ways, you know? Be selfish if you have to be selfish, you know? Like,
So back to the performing. Is the entire audience distanced and masked and such? I mean,
so they distance the audience by like chairs and tables now are like farther apart, and there's limited seating.
And no standing room, so yep, none of that kind of stuff.
You have to have a seat, and the door people are there, and they're like they count how many people are in, and if there's more than that many people, they have to wait outside, like. Standing line outside, just somebody leaves. I mean, you don't have to have a mask on when you're eating or drinking, but I've noticed a lot of the audience wears their mask and only slips their straw under their mask, or they'll take their mask off if they're eating, but then they put their mask on when they're done. Like, that's pretty good. I'm really happy when I see that, because that shows a little bit of like responsibility for yourself and others, you know?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Well, and I mean, to be fair, anybody that's a drag show is a pretty open-minded and thoughtful person. Like, Proud Boys are not showing up at drag shows. Like, no. So the people that are being idiots about this whole thing probably aren't at the show in the first place.
Yeah.
So you are dealing with some of the... Yeah, right? Exactly. So you're at least surrounded by people who are a little bit more aware in the first place.
I've noticed over the years, though, just for in gay bars and stuff, that it's there used to be a lot more idiots and like girls bringing their boyfriends to the gay bar and them getting all like riled up and angry because a guy hit on them, stuff like that. There's a lot less of that now. Like that was a huge thing, like 90s, even up to the 2000s, early 2000s. Like, but I see a lot less of that now, a lot less of the weird, homophobic, strange, frat boy kind of behaviors in the bar, which is good.
It is good, and it does show the change in society as a whole. I think it's less and less quote cool to be that homophobe, and so that's gone away too.
Well, I think some of that has come back though, because it's like I don't think it ever really left. I just think that it's like people weren't given the option to do that until the last 4 years.
Where people are encouraged to be that.
Now you can be a racist, homophobic, misogynistic twat waffle and become president.
Good riddance.
I just got like so miffed at the fact that no matter how many times he was asked, he would never denounce white supremacist organizations.
Still hasn't. He also still hasn't admitted defeat. It's been 3 days.
Well, everybody's like, well, you ever tried to tell a toddler that they have to leave the toy department?
Yep. It's exactly that. Well, and he has a verifiable mental illness.
Oh, he is a textbook case for narcissism. Narcissist. Everything a narcissist is.
Not in his vocabulary to admit that he ever lost. Ever. It's just not in him, even though he's gone bankrupt umpteen zillion times.
He takes other people's, like, things they've done good and claims them for himself, you know, like...
Right. And not to be fatalistic about it, but this could be part of what drives us into a much uglier time in America, is when he refuses to leave. Yep. And what happens then?
I just thank goodness that I'm, like, on the other side of the country.
Well, you know, unfortunately,
I live in a second floor apartment that I can barricade if I have to.
He's gonna target the states that are more left leaning, and we live in one of them.
Yeah,
and that's all fucking charming. I'm gonna get off that topic.
Yeah,
because it's it's going to be a perfect world. It's going to be a graceful transition. Everything's going to be marvelous, right?
Well, that's what I've been lighting candles for. Candles and sacrificing babies. No, I don't sacrifice babies. That's horrible. It is so painful like that because people believe me sometimes. Like I was telling a client today, I'm like, yeah, they say my wound's healing really well. And she goes, well, that's great. And I'm like, yeah, it's all the baby sacrifices. And she just like stopped. And she's been coming to me for years. She should know my sense of humor by now.
Right.
She just stared at me. I'm like, oh, I'm kidding. I don't sacrifice babies. And then, of course, like Jenna Lee's behind me at her station. And she goes, nope, you don't sacrifice them. You just strip them of their fat so you can make candles. I'm like, how else am I supposed to apply, Jenna Lee? Like, how else am I supposed to apply?
Just throwing that fat fuel on the fire, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have the same problem. I tell people my pit bull eats baby faces, and they don't always get the humor in it. He gets it. He thinks it's funny.
They're so juicy and tender.
Right? Especially when they're fresh off the skull. Like, that's the best way. Baby faces. So
baby pieces.
Okay, so I'm going to move you into the actual five questions because the first one we've obviously done the introduction part and talked enough about the shit state of the world. Next question is, can you define happy or happiness?
No.
Ooh.
No. I thought a lot about that actually recently, like a lot about that. And I'll stem from a Beyonce song called Pretty Hurts. Because in the beginning of that song, she's in beauty pageant. And she's asked the question of, what do you want in the future? What do you want more than anything for the future? And she says, I want to be happy. And, you know, that's all I've ever wanted, too. And I mean, there's bursts of joy and there's bursts of happiness that I've had, but I wouldn't know what happiness really is. You know, like I don't know how to be happy all the time or really what feels like happiness, if that makes any sense.
It does.
It's confusing to me, but
first off, I would toss in, let yourself on the hook. Nobody's happy all the time. So just toss that out the fucking window. But
yeah.
But you said at least you have bursts of happiness or joy or pleasure or.
Well, yeah.
I don't remember the exact words you used.
Know, I know what moments of happiness are, like, I guess, but I don't think I've ever been able to be happy, like 100% happy. Cause I always have this thing in the back of my head. That's like, fortunately I'm on meds now, so that might change, but I've always had the thing in the back of my head, that voice going like, someday they're all going to find out that you're a fraud. And then they're all going to hate you. And then there's the other voice. It's like, don't listen to them. Be more worried about like what bad thing is going to happen next. You know, there's been too good for too long now. You know, we've had 20 minutes of joy. There's going to be something bad happening soon. Let's pay attention and watch out for that, which I know is illogical and crazy because that just makes your brain go, oh, I better watch out for that. So then you're focused on what kind of bad thing is going to happen next. You're not focused on enjoying the moment of happiness that you get. So yeah, I think my mental, like, illness is like cause for me not to know or really understand or live in the moment with happiness. So I don't really know how to define happiness or what that would be even, because yeah, all the other thoughts.
Wow. So do you ever have even accidentally prolonged times of happiness, or is it just those tiny spurts?
Well, there's been times like I like when I'm at Gemini Party or event, those seem to like be longer bursts of happiness. And I'm really happy when, like, if I'm tripping balls, and my best moment So the longest moments of happiness have been like on hallucinogens and ignoring everybody around me. Like my longest bursts of happiness have been altered and alone, or at least like headphones on, not paying attention to me, not letting anybody break the little bit of magic going on around me, you know?
Well, it sounds like not letting anybody, including yourself, because yeah. you're kind of out of your head. And so those voices that are beating you down so frequently aren't allowed to come in the door either.
Well, I used to tell people all the time, like, nobody fucks me like I fuck me. And I don't mean that in like the sexual sense. I just mean my brain has never been my friend. It's always been the enemy. Like, so all the people living in my head that are telling me different things. And like my schizophrenic friend said, like, the voices never tell you anything nice. Like, the voices in your head rarely say, hey, you're doing a good job, buddy. Keep it going. You're wonderful. It's wonderful.
Yeah, not many of us have a cheerleader laying around inside of us going, woo, you're doing great. It's generally that you really kind of fucked that up, or you really could have done better in this way.
Or you just generally suck and nobody likes you and they'll just pretend, or, you know, someday they're all going to find out that you're the devil and, you know, run from you, and people are going to know you're a fraud and you have no skill or talent, or, you know, those things. Or my favorite, do you really think you're smart enough or strong enough or, you know, cool enough or attractive enough or skilled enough for blank? Do you? Like, don't you think there's more deserving people out there that are better than you? Like, thanks, Mom. You know.
I mean, they have a word for that now. It's called imposter syndrome, like where you never believe that you're good enough to have what you have, that you don't deserve to have what you have, including you on screen. There you are again.
Yeah, I bumped, I adjusted the phone stand, I bumped it, and I totally like went to like the stupid key that makes everything go away.
I mean, the good news is when you go away, I still get to see your face. It's just not a moving one any longer. But yeah, I mean, they call it imposter syndrome now, where you talk yourself into the fact that you're not worthy of having whatever you have, or whatever, achieving whatever you've achieved, or doing whatever you've done, or, you know, I'm not qualified enough to fix that thing, or I'm not, when in fact you are. And
well, I think a lot of people that grew up in fear have it. Like my primary care provider, she's like, I want to set you up with, you know, a reference for, to make sure we get you like therapy and stuff besides just the pills. She goes, but I'd really like to get you set up with a psychiatrist instead of a therapist. She goes, cause I think you have a lot of stuff that needs deeper help from your childhood and your youth and even your young adulthood. And I think that would help you a lot. And I was like, I think you might be right. Cause when I went to Walport for like 3 weeks, it was miserable. I was like, every day, every night I cried. Like every morning, every evening I cried when I was on the coast taking care of my dad. And like 3 days before I left, my dad and me were driving up the river, Elsie River, and he goes, you must be doing better here. And I'm like, what do you mean? And he goes, well, you didn't cry this morning. And I'm like, what? And he goes, you cried every morning and every night. Sometimes in your sleep, I hear you and I come out and look and you're asleep and you're crying. Like, I know that you're horribly miserable here, and I know that this place sucks the life right out of you, and I'm sorry that I needed your help. I'm like, don't be sorry you need my help. I could have said no. And he goes, yeah, but you wouldn't. And I'm like, well, you're right. I wouldn't, but I could have if I wanted to.
Well, and the fact that you didn't say no automatically qualifies you for having the strength to be able to do it. And
somebody had to take care of him, you know? He wiped my ass for, like, 2 years of my life. I can go and help make sure that he doesn't have to bend over or pull or push anything for a month, you know, like.
And that's the voice that I wish more of us could hear more often, is the one that says, but you did that. And that's what makes you a valuable and worthy person, is the fact that you don't even question. Like, of course I'm going to go do that. And that's what gives you value. And I think that voice is a little too quiet for most of us. It would be cool if we could hear it more. But maybe that's why we're here for each other, is to remind each other of that shit. Like, no, you're good. Like, you're a good person. Look what you did without even thinking about it. And being that voice you don't get to hear from yourself. Because, again, there's no cheerleaders running around in most side of it, inside of most of us.
Wouldn't it be great if there was?
Oh, God. Well, I don't know if I'd ever leave the bedroom. But, you know. Not to be old and creepy, but, you know.
Hey, you know, we are old. We are creepy. We're unavoidable.
I know. I look like I tie you to train tracks. It's creepy, you know?
I have a fake mustache that I bought that I was going to wear for, like, a Halloween costume at some point, and I still can somehow. But it reminds me of your mustache. It's kind of thicker, and then, it comes out. And it's already stiffened with, like, glue wax, so it doesn't change shape. Like, it always just kind of has that, like,
straight out.
Every time I look at it, I'm just like, God, I want a wide-brimmed, flat-topped hat and a cape. I just want to be like, so give me the deed. Marry me or you'll be run over by the train.
At the beginning of this whole thing, I got this.
Oh,
which, if you know me, is fucking hilarious.
That is so awesome.
But the political sentiment around running around in a Guy Fawkes mask, I wore it like 3 times. Like, I'm scaring people. That's not good. But, like, people who knew me, like the people at the grocery store I go to all the time, like, that's funny.
One of the first masks I made has this, like, cotton backing that's all little rainbows, but then, like, a rainbow scarf somebody gave me. Neckerchief, it's like tie-dye rainbow. I put that over the top of it so it gives this extra weird layer. And then I put one of my eye patches that has the eyelashes on the top and the bottom right there in the middle of where my mouth is. And so I'd wear that everywhere for like a month. Like this whole like puffy mask with like this eyeball right in my mouth and like rainbows. And people are always like, that's insane. And I'm like, but? And they're like, it's good insane.
It is. All right. So do you feel like you're not qualified to have that good insane part come out? Or does that just come out of you?
It just comes out. Like, the goofy craziness in me, my inner clown, like, it comes out a lot. And frequently it's filthy and messed up. But, and I do get happiness from, like, other people laughing. You know, like, I really enjoy making people happy, or at least feeling happy. You know, like, I think that's why I do the drag and why I try to be, like, whenever I'm out in public, I try to be on point, like, with, like, my humor, sense of humor, that stuff, you know. Because sad, sad, boring, quiet Gene is not an exciting person or a fun person to be around. So... that's why I tell people, like, when they want to go out after I've had, like, 8-hour day at work. And they're like, hey, you want to come over to the house? And I'm like, no. And I'm like, well, why not? I'm like, so just get off work. And they're like, but I don't get it. Well, I'm on point, Rama. I'm on. I'm turned on the whole time I'm at work because I have to be like, hey, how you doing, girl? You're looking good. Because people expect that of me. When inside in the back of my head I'm going like, oh, you're a miserable cunt. Really don't want to be here. I'd rather be at home having some tea, you know, eating, like, snacks on the couch, like, watching some movies. Why am I working? Oh, yeah, pay bills, be nice.
So that at some other time you can eat snacks on the couch and watch movies, that's why you're working?
Yep, exactly, exactly.
But, like, battle through all this muck.
A lot of people don't realize, like, so when I worked retail, I had to be happy all the time, but only when I was in front of people. Like,
right.
I only had to be happy when I was talking to a customer. When I was, like, folding stuff and putting on tables or hanging racks or sizing racks, I didn't have to be a constant state of smile and happy and perky and bubbly until I saw somebody enter and then I'd be perky and bubbly. But as a hairdresser, the moment I walk in that door, like, no one, I walk in the door of the salon, other people's clients know me. Like, I'm not just, like, being bubbly and perky and funny for my client. I'm doing it because that's what other people, other stylist clients expect of me. And I noticed in my salon, we all have our role we play. Each one of us has a separate role. And like my coworker, Emily, is the princess of perky. She is positive, 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 110% of the time. Everything out of her mouth is sweet, kind, positive, uplifting. Generally is a little more realistic. Funny still, but very straightforward and kind of surly. And there's me. I'm the clown. And the couple of times I haven't been the clown, then it's like, oh, is Gene okay? Is he feeling okay? You know, then all the other girls get really worried that I'm not doing okay. And they're like, are you sure you're okay? Do you have to go see a doctor? Do you need a ride to the hospital?
Well, for what it's worth, it's good that you have people in your world that pay attention to you in that arena, because that tends to be an arena you may not give yourself enough attention in, but...
I really don't. Like, that's why I say I'm an adult who doesn't know how to adult. I'm an adult who's not adulting. This is weird. This is the first year I've went a whole year without my electricity getting turned off.
Wow. Well, congratulations.
I know. Like, it's a
in the middle year. In the middle of a global pandemic, you've had an absolute success.
Yeah. And like, but I still like, I made like really, really beautiful decoupage boxes, fancy, blingy, crazy, gluing shit to other shit boxes for each one of the girls in the salon. Cause I'm like, and inside the box, like on the bottom box, I wrote, thank you for being my adult and keeping me alive. Because they decided that I'm a Tamagotchi.
Oh, really? A pocket pen who needs attention every once in a while.
If they don't pay enough attention, I've shit all over my house, and I've, like, you know, gotten sick, and I'm on the verge of dying.
That's not a bad life, actually. I mean, you're kind of catered to if you're a Tamagotchi. I remember my kid and his older siblings having Tamagotchis, and the hours and hours and hours, they keep just trying to keep the damn things alive. You understand? Yeah. You just take the batteries out, it's dead no matter what, right? No.
Well, my friend Janelle, she's like, we need to get you a t-shirt that looks like a Tamagotchi, like with the gray screen in the middle, mm-hmm. and like says Tamagotchi on some pastel colors. And I should wear it because, like, honestly, like, as sad as it sounds, I'm a 48-year-old Tamagotchi.
I can't. I'll argue it's kind of a privileged place, though. You pay attention to what you can pay attention to. You got other people to pay attention to the other things. Works out all right, I think. So far, we still got you.
I'm still alive. I've had enough people to be like, hey, stupid, you're dying. You need to go to the hospital. I'm taking you right now. Let's go. You know, okay. Oh, you just posted that Monday's canceled. You're going to take a nap on the kitchen floor. Like, are you okay? Do I have to call an ambulance? Is this how I kill you? Is this how you die? I'll call you when I wake up from my nap on the kitchen floor.
Yeah. You might should call before the nap on the kitchen floor, honey. Just for future reference. When that's a good plan, anywhere before 3 in the morning.
That was that weird Christmas, was the, like, generally saw me post at Monday's cancel. I'm going to take a nap here on the kitchen floor. And she made me go to the ER, which thank God I did, because they were like, yeah, you waited another day, you probably would have died. Oh, okay. My bad. That every 3 to 4 years, I do something stupid and, like, try to kill myself. I don't know if it's me consciously doing it or just the universe goes, bitch, we're going to try and take you out again.
I was just going to argue that it might be more of a universal reminder situation than you doing it yourself. Because you don't run around. It's not like you're stabbing yourself in the eyeball or anything. It's
No, I'm not deliberately trying to kill myself.
Yeah, you just end up on the verge of death every 4 years or so. Because the universe needs to remind you that you're the queen that you are. And
so you need to take care of yourself occasionally. If something feels weird, maybe go and get it looked at, you know?
Yeah, maybe.
If everybody tells you that you're gray, your skin is turning gray, and you've lost a ton of weight, and you're passing out while walking down the stairs, or, like, just randomly, you know, like, you bump your arm and you are in crippling pain, that should be a sign that you should go to the ER. Not wait another week or two and then be drugged to the ER by your friend because, like, they're done watching you try and kill yourself, you know? My dad does the same thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're not alone in it. Like, I'll ignore an ailment forever. And it very well may be the death of me eventually. But you're not alone in this. Just so you know, I know I'm kind of guilting you and finger wagging a little bit. But it's only because I love you and I like having you around. Not because I'm not guilty myself.
Well, I think we just have a society that wants that. They want, like, it tells you, like, from the time you start working, you've got bosses that are like, you try to call in sick and they guilt you because you're not feeling well. No, we need you in here. You're not that sick. You can't be that sick. Get in here, you know?
Well, and society also built a place that a lot of our self-worth is based around what we can do, create, achieve, you know, earn, gain, etc. And that's all based in working, working, working. And so it's not based in, well, hold up, take care of yourself for a second. So that is another piece of society that pushes us in this direction. And then with that philosophy, we become bosses and beat up on it. Like, I've been known to go, oh man, you've been sick 3 times this month. Well, I've been known to be that guy.
There's jobs that are set up where they're like, when I worked for Penny's Salon, like, you were only allowed to be sick so many days in the year.
Mm-hmm.
If you were sick more than those, then you'd better have been hospitalized and have documentation of it, or you could get fired. Like,
yep.
That's insanity. Like, there's other countries where if you're sick, you stay home, you get better, and you come back to work. You know, like, because people get sick, especially when you work with the public.
Yeah, funny thing about every living creature or being, be it plants even, on the planet, they all get illnesses. It happens. And our particular society here in the U.S. is not set up to deal with that for...
Oh, no.
I'm not clear on what reason.
I tell people all the time, like, there's no money to be made in getting people healthy.
It's true. There's a lot more money to solving your emergency than there is to keeping you from having one.
Yep.
Yep. Again, what we're just talking about, all the cheerful shit, Gene.
Yeah. It's kind of the way I feel. It might just be the way that I am. I'm just, sorry about that. The world's kind of a shithole at the moment, and I'm now seeing all the shithole that's going on. So it's like...
Yeah,
that's another thing. I realized I let myself go a lot of years not paying truly a whole lot of attention to what was going on in the world or around me.
Mm.
Like, deliberately forcing myself to just blindly walk through life and just be like concerned about my little microcosm of the world, like my little corner of the world. And now that I'm seeing, like, when the COVID thing started, like, seeing all the weirdness and then seeing all the bad stuff, and like, I knew there was systemic racism, I knew there was, you know, white privilege, I understood these things, but I didn't really understand them until last couple of years, and especially the last couple of months, like just the last 6-7 months. I'm like,
yeah, the last 6-7 months has been like 4 years.
Yeah.
There's that.
Like that.
But in that 6-month, 4-year span, we've been presented with all these ways where we're kind of forced to look at these issues. That, like you said, I knew there was systemic racism. I knew that there was a problem with the way that the police were trained. Like, my first experience with the Portland Police Bureau was in the early 90s, and I came out on better terms with the people that mugged me than the officers that came to respond to the call. Like, I've known for that long, but this year has really put it in front of us in a lot of ways. And the way that we can have just as, like, we all go through small changes, you know, we lose a job or we end a relationship or what have you, but the globe together has gone through this dramatic change. Like, we're all over the globe dealing with, how do we deal with this thing that we can't cure and we don't want to use to kill our friends and family and loved ones? And how do we do that? We're just not. And seeing that on such a broad spectrum and sharing it with the whole world is something new and different to us, I think.
Well, like Kesha said, what if rich white straight men didn't rule the world?
Frankly, as a admittedly lower middle class, but still middle class white male who is generally straight presenting, I'm still okay with that plan. Just totally okay with that plan.
Well, I had a... So it's like I realized recently that I picked the way that I appear to people and how I present every day. I picked it for safety. Oh, sorry.
You're okay.
I bumped it again. I picked it for safety. Like, I portray a cis male. I'm a cis white male, but I portray, you know, a male appearing dude. Like, and I never wanted to be that. I always wanted to be like a mix of both, like just kind of gender fluid type appearance all my life. I've wanted that. And I picked this because when I came out and became an adult, this was the safest thing for me. Like, I didn't realize that until this year too. That was another big epiphany I got this year. So I'm like, well, shit, you know, like as I've gotten older, I've become more effeminate in my appearance, like the no eyebrows and the nails, too much jewelry most of the time, but it was never really
just the right amount of
jewelry. Much as I wanted to be. You
know? Some of that is we didn't have those options in our age. You know, I've always leaned a little bit more toward the, you know, I'm going to wear a blouse instead of a shirt, that kind of thing, androgyny edge a little bit. Which androgyny seems like an antique of a word at this point in time. But we also didn't have that option as much as we do now. Like, kids, when we were 19 and trying to figure that shit out, we didn't see what a 19-year-old today sees as other options. And so...
Well, when I was like 18, 19, that was the like... first insurgence of Lon Mabon and the Citizens Alliance. Like,
yeah.
A group that was putting ballot measures out there to rescind.
No on nine. Absolutely.
And rights that were human rights that were given to people, but take those away. Like, they wanted to take away rights for anybody in the LGBTQ community.
Yeah.
And, like, that was nuts. And there's riots and there was, like, protests. And I was living in Portland and, yeah. I had friends that lived their lives gender neutral, like, and at the time, and they'd get called names and stuff. A couple of them even got beat up, you know. And I think I saw that and went, oh, I'm not going to do that.
And so you end up putting on this facade for protection. And yeah, like I said, I think it's partially because we weren't afforded the same structure that we have now. Like now, if you and I are walking down the street and we see a trans kid on the street getting harassed, we'll stand up for them. And in the early 90s, when we were somehow adjacent to being those kids, not necessarily trans kids ourselves, but somehow adjacent to it, nobody would stand up for us, with the exception of our, you know, handful of friends, and all of our handful of friends looked like fucking weirdos too.
One night walking down Stark, I had my leather jacket on, it was in drag, me and Sierra, and this guy like came barreling through between me and Sierra, pushed Sierra out of the way and grabbed my leather jacket and tried to take it from me. Well, I had one arm in it. So I just wrapped that arm around my like chest and like give me my jacket back. You're not going to get it off me, fucker. And we fought. People gathered around watching me fight this man, like hitting him, punching him, him punching me. I'm trying to get the jacket off of me for like a fucking $80 Wilton's leather motorcycle jacket. Like really, like Now
I have one of those jackets, so it meant the world to us.
Yeah, I was like, why didn't I just give him the fucking jacket? Well, because that was my favorite fucking jacket. I wore that as a boy and a girl. That was my favorite piece of clothing at the time. And it wasn't until the cop car showed up that anybody did anything. It was the cops that pulled the two of us apart and cuffed him because they had heard, one of the other cops had heard people saying, you know, this guy tried to take her jacket. And I overheard, and I remember hearing the one cop go, "You mean his jacket?"
What's sad is some cop in Portland said that same shit yesterday.
Yeah. Like, okay, so I was always taught, even before this was a thing, I was always taught as a kid that if it walks like a duck, it talks like a duck, it's a duck. Who are you to judge it otherwise? You know, like, if it looks like a girl, it could be a girl. If it looks like a boy, it could be a boy. Now it's a little more confusing, I think, because there's a lot of people that are like, I ask people their pronouns now because I learned my lessons. And I've got clients that, like, sometimes, one of my favorite clients, sometimes she comes in and she's had a rough week and she's not shaved. But everybody at the salon still calls her herb and lady and ma'am and girl, and because that's what she is.
That's what she is. Exactly.
I have clients that are definitely they, thems. And sometimes they portray a little more masculine, sometimes a little more feminine, but they're they, them. I tried to take more of a Norwegian standpoint on it, like, because Norway doesn't, they don't have gender-specific words, really. They don't use gender-specific things in their school system, especially. Like, everybody's neutral. It's all gender-neutral. It's all they, them.
You know how old that is? The Sumerians didn't have gender-specific words. The Sumerians. Yeah, like, my cat is named Ninani, and Nin is the male and or female and or other possessive term. It is theirs, in essence. Their. Ani being queen. Their queen. That's it. Like, the possessive is not a him or a her. It's a just theirs, ours. It seems so simple because it's been around for so long, but somewhere along the line, we totally lost track of that.
I like to think that maybe it was the start of, like, Christian religion, maybe.
I like to blame it on religion in general because, I mean, Buddhism definitely separates the male from the female.
Yeah.
You know, and it's older than Christianity, technically. Islamic faiths definitely separate the male from the female.
But they're also kind of like male-dominated religions.
Yep.
Like, you don't want to give women power or equality. Like, don't make them an equal because, like, they're crazy and terrifying. And they bleed for 7 days. And
they don't die from it.
They don't die. and they can poison your water supply by crossing a river. You know, it's like, what the fuck, people?
Well, at the same time, like, even that has made little sense to me because tracing the family lineage through men makes less sense than tracing it through women. You know
exactly
what woman the child came out of. You don't know what man the child came out of.
Yep. Well, that's what I love about, like, Judaism is that,
mm-hmm,
to be born Jewish, you have to have a Jewish mother.
Yes.
It doesn't matter if the father's Jewish, the mother has to be Jewish. It's a pass down line. Because that's true. It's you don't know where what man did it, you know. And you know it came out of a woman, and you know the woman gave birth to that, you know. That's my thing, is why weren't women more revered when I was going to Baptist and other Christian churches? Like, why didn't they revere women more when you figure, like, women can do things that men can't? Like, yeah. I can't make a baby. I can't squeeze the baby out. Ouch. You know, I can't feed that baby. No milk comes out of my nipples.
Nope. They're superfluous. They're there for feeling and looks, I guess.
Mine aren't even there for feeling. Mine are just there to be annoying. It's just chest decoration for me because they're not sensitive at all.
One more thing to shave in your world, huh?
Yeah. Yep. Just one more thing to shave and get in the way. They're like little tiny pale pepperonis just glued to my chest. They do nothing. They serve no purpose.
Hey, pepperonis serve lots of purpose. I'm a huge fan of pepperoni. So my next question for you, my friend.
Okay.
Is, this is a great time. Thanks. I'm having a ball. It's so good to see you. My next question is, what can you do to help other people be happy?
I think I do it. Like, I like to think that I try. Like, I'd like to believe that I try really hard to make people happy. Like, because I've always been like, well, I'm in a customer service. Well, I don't know if I can still call it a customer service industry at the moment. But
it's still service.
Like, industry. Hair.
Yeah.
I do hair in the beauty industry. And it people feel good when they look good. And everybody in the salon I work at, like, everybody is so appreciative of everybody else's clients and so, like, honest and complimentary to everybody's clients. Like, unfortunately, I'm not. Because I'm like, if I see somebody and they've done, they're, like, getting ready to leave and they have, like, the crappiest looking, like, look, I'm like, I'll be like, ooh, nice. But that's where I end it. Or I'll be like, oh, that's a great cut. And then I'll end it there. Or you work it, girl. And then I walk away because I know I'm going to say something horrible if I don't. And when I give somebody a compliment, like, that's one thing Emily said, like, where she's like, when you give somebody a compliment, like, she goes, I've told my clients, because they come back to me and they've been like, so, yeah, Jean was really complimentary. Told me that I looked really good, and the haircut color was great on me and everything, and good choice. And I don't know. And Emily, like, yeah, he was being honest, because if he didn't like what it looked like, he would just be polite. And I'm like, oh, my God, they're right. But like, I'm also very, like, I try to make people laugh and I try to make people feel good about themselves and joy and happy with themselves. That's my big goal. I just want everybody to be able to be 100% happy in themselves or be themselves. I just want people to be 100% them.
Do you think that's why you are so comfortable in the clown costume?
Yeah.
Is that you get to be you and show other people that it's cool to be you?
I think that might be, yeah. Because, like, Alana, the Alana costume is a totally different creature. It's like the little part inside me that's kind of like the spoiled brat kind of bitch, like the popular girl in school that was also a slut. You know, that's like kind of what I feel like when I'm in drag.
Hell, honey, Alana's thrown me off the stage, so.
Yeah.
That's but real. Then, it happened.
Yeah.
I was misbehaving. Like, you know, I deserved it.
Then there's, like, the clown that just, like, I really think that a lot of the Miss Tickle's character is me, vice versa. Like, not the sad gene, but, you know, the happy gene. I mean, like, when I'm the clown, I can be wild and crazy and tell horrible jokes and be, like, filthy, dirty, but flirty and... Like, because I can't get up on stage like this and do this. I can't just be funny and talk and everything to an audience. But if you put me in, like, a clown costume or drag or some other costume, put me in front of an auditorium of people. And I'll make at least half of them crack up. But I'll also make them like themselves, hopefully, at the end of it. You know? I mean, there is that frat boy in me that wants to, like, haze people and make them feel uncomfortable and awkward because, you know, that's fun. But I try to keep that one locked up a bit, you know.
For good reason, yeah.
Every drag queen that's worked with me in a show, like a long-running show, has told me that I'm a hazer, that I'm a college person, I'm a frat boy. And it's true. Every long-running show I've been involved in, the new person comes in and I haze the fuck out of them. Like, I find something... I just go at it and at it and at it until they finally realize I'm doing it. And then I'm like, oops, sorry. You're part of the crew now. Like, well,
there's entrance requirements. You know, yeah. it's things you have to do to become part of any culture. You gotta prove yourself to some way. And
like the first time I realized that Riri Caliente, the one drag queen, when she started working at the show, now she's my boss at shows. But before that, like I realized she was blind as a bat. And I knew how she put her makeup, touched her makeup up, and where she'd put the pot of makeup, and where she'd have to get up to the mirror really close, the thing like that, you know, to put it on. When she'd get up to the mirror, I would push the makeup that she was using, like, 3 inches away or 2 inches away. So when she put her brush directly down, it wouldn't be there. And so then she'd have to get, like, she'd have to lean forward and be like 3 inches from the table, looking all over the table to find that pot of makeup. And I did this for 3.5 months of shows every Friday. Every Friday, I did this multiple times throughout the course of the night. And it was finally at like 3.5 month point that she's in the mirror and she's doing this. And I sneak my hand over. And I'm still looking in the mirror, putting on lipstick with the other hand. And I'm like, sneak my hand over, and I can't find the pot. And all of a sudden, I feel something on my hand. She reached in and grabbed my hand. And she goes, I know what you're doing. And I'm like, you're part of the group now. And she's like, you're a sick fucking bitch. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I know who I am.
Yeah.
It's like, I can't stop myself. And then, like, Fabulous is backstage. And so it's like, the other girl from the show, and they both turn and they go, yeah, that's Alana. She hazes everybody. She's like a college boy, like a frat boy. And I'm like, oh my God, in drag, I'm a frat boy.
First off, and I mean this in the most loving way, but damn, you're a bitch.
it's all harmless. Like, I'm not like forcing people to drink like a mixture of gross or anything. Like, I'm a long game player. I can do the same wicked, slightly malicious prank on a person every day they let me until they stop me from doing it for months, months and months.
So, secondly,
I'm the prince of petty and passive aggressive.
Well, and that actually gets it even further into it. It's curious to me because I mean, like, you're my best into the drag culture. I mean, you're my real version of RuPaul's Drag Race. And and that's how I get my insights. But it's curious to me that y'all get to be boys and girls all at the same time and how that dynamic works. Can you explain to me how that works a little bit?
I still have not figured that out yet. Like,
okay. Then it's not just me, at least.
I think it's something about, I think it kind of boils down to penises. You know, like, because I've known lots of, like, bio queens, a lot of drag queens that have performed for years that have been real women. And they don't have that man side. Like, they don't have that man side when they're dressed up in drag because they're still in girl shit, you know?
So, yeah, biologically, the parts are still female.
Yeah. And I think that, like, even though bio queens go hyper female, they still are females. I don't think they have that ability to, like, be back and forth on that line. Like, I am more angry and willing to fight. Like, I will get physically in fist fights. I will jump in a mosh pit and drag, but I wouldn't do it as a boy. I have bigger balls and more testosterone flowing through me when I'm in a cincher and wig and heels than ever as a guy. Like, I have people look at me and be like, wow, Lana's a lot more butch than Jean. And I'm like, I know, isn't that weird?
It is weird.
How's that work? And just who I am, like, I think it's a comfort. I think it's also comfortable, like a comfortability. Is that a word?
Sure. This person in Jean. Yeah, go for it.
Yeah. I think it's just that, like, a lot of drag queens are more comfortable in that costume. And so you can allow your boy to be visible in personality, you know? I mean, does that make any sense?
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, and it comes full circle to finding comfort in your skin by wearing a costume, which is kind of where a lot of this conversation started, seems like a moon ago. But, you know, where we kind of started with this is wearing a costume allows you to bring out personality traits that don't necessarily come out. And it sounds like maybe even your testosterone-based personality traits. I don't want to call them masculine, but they're testosterone-based, you know. Like, flapping your penis around in the locker room is something only testosterone-driven people do.
Yeah.
Like, I've known a few bull dykes that would be more than happy to have testosterone and a giant piece of blue rubber flopping around and be a part of that team.
I have quite a few female clients that are, like, definitely, like, butch dykes that if they had a dick, they have a dick. Like, it may be an imaginary dick. It may not be really in their pants, but inside their heart and soul, they have a dick, and it is a big one. And they got that big dick energy, and they're not, like, they're giving it up. Like, I have one client that I just love. I love going out with her because she's, like, she's pretty. Like, she's just naturally, just physically pretty. She's everything art schools tell you is pretty for females. Like, facial features, hair, the works. But she walks like a bodybuilder. Like,
with a professional. Puffed out wrestler. Arm kind
like,
of thing.
She's and... just, she is just a, I would not, if I saw her and didn't know her, I would like walk the other side of the street. I'd cross the street. So I'd be afraid she'd kick me ass just because she saw me. Like, not that I'd do anything, just that she would do it because she's good. And I joke with her all the time, like, you got a big fucking cock there. And she does. Like, even though, like, it's not physically there, it's definitely spiritually and emotionally and, like, mentally there. And I love that about her. Like, she's, like, the butchest of butch, but it's nuts. When we're, like, in the same room together, it's great. Because when I'm around people like that, I get even more feminine. I become even more, like, you know... like girly and like fragile,
demure. Like, maybe
I never thought of myself as fragile or dainty or delicate, but when I'm around a woman with that kind of big dick energy, I am a fragile, delicate creature. Like,
well, I have a friend locally. I have a friend locally that I've known since her mid teens, and I've seen her grow up and become more in touch with herself. And like, she has some big dick energy, and even I, the cis, relatively straight male presenting guy that I am, will become a little bit more apologetic and back the fuck up when she's in, because it's her room. It's hers, clearly. It's an interesting dynamic.
Advice.
What's that?
Best advice I've ever given. I give it to every young man. The best advice I give to every young man is, like, I want you to know, women, the good thing about floating between both worlds is that I get an insight into both, and I've watched, and I have great insight into how men think and how they function and how women think and how they function. And I love looking at young men and being like, so the next time you can't understand your girlfriend or you're confused by her or whatever, just think this and remember that the female of any species is always going to be stronger, smarter, faster, more cunning, and more beguiling than you can ever imagine being. There's no way around it. Like, I'm a gay man and I'm a lot feminine brained, but I'll tell you, I'm never going to be as smart, as sharp, as cunning, as fast, as dangerous as any born female out there. Like, dude, as a man, you're born kind of stupid. Just play it. Use what you got. Use the talent that you're given and stand back and watch what happens. Like, they'll call you if they need you, but stand the fuck back. And like, girls come to me and they're like, oh gosh, Gene, like, my boyfriend, I just don't understand him. I don't know why. Like, I can't get a guy to keep him. I'm like, men need five things, honey. That's all they need. Basic five things. Four of them their mother gives them from birth, like from birth on. You can give them the fifth thing, and that's sex. Be good at sex. That's all you need. You can control a man for years.
I'm really curious what the first four are.
Feeding him, sheltering him, putting out, getting him off. Like, if you get him off good and you can cook a meal and tell him he's a wonderful good boy, like, pat him on the head, you can keep him forever. Like, those three things are the biggest part in most adult men's lives. Like, that's what they want from their girlfriends. That's why mommies, like, that's why they leave their moms, is because their moms aren't putting out. Like, if mommy's put out, the boys would never leave home.
Well, I mean, there is an argument to be made that is why that the cis straight male is referred to as a dog. Is, tell me I'm a good boy, feed me once in a while, pet me, get me off.
Scratch me on the head.
Is essentially, yeah. Yep.
all these girls are like, that can't be that easy. I'm like, no, sweetie, I'll tell you, as a man, as the male side of me, that is that easy. I am that easy. Like, that's all I need. You give me that and I'll stay with you forever. I won't even leave. You could, like, you can kick me every now and then if you need to, just as long as you're feeding me and scratching my head and telling me I'm a good boy, you know, like, because it's the way men are built. We're physical. Like, most men are physically based. Most women are emotionally based. So I tell boys, like, watch out. Girls are emotional. They're smarter, faster, stronger, meaner, sneakier, brilliant. Like, love them, appreciate them, and stand back, dude. Don't try and control, because they'll just tear you up.
Well, they see things.
No way. Kept being sewn into a bed sheet with the bed on fire and then beating you with a broomstick. You know, like.
They see things that I would argue that those of us who are plumbed with penises don't see. For whatever reason. Like, scientifically, I don't think we understand it yet. But there's a callback to ancient cultures and the way that the woman had to be so much in tune with so many things because they were in charge of the health of the child and making sure the child's safety was intact and finding the day-to-day food. Because, like, the hunter-gatherer situation, the gatherer is who fed everybody every day. The hunter fed them once every couple of weeks, you know? And yeah, it was a great feast and it was a wonderful thing and they felt, woo-woo, like, look what I brought home. But they forgot that everybody else survived when they weren't there. And so there's all these aspects built into the traditional female characteristic mind that just don't exist in the traditional characteristic male mind. And so, of course, they're able to be more in tune or sharper or, as you put it, more dangerous. Using my voice, that sounds like something I shouldn't say. But because I'm having this conversation with you, I'll let myself off.
No, I think that I really truly believe that women are more dangerous. Like, they're the more dangerous of our species, like, especially, you know, like, if they're taught power when they're young, like, if you take a girl, a little girl, and you raise her to be secure in who she is and to know that she is just as good as anybody else, watch the fuck out, because that little girl could take over the world. And you get a whole army of these little girls that are raised to be, like, secure and safe and understand who they are and taught to be strong and that there's nothing different from them as a boy except for that they're, like, usually a little smarter and advanced faster. Because girls definitely come into their own a lot faster than boys do.
Yeah, they
do. That's just science, you know. You teach them these things, and if you can keep them away from learning about, like, oh, you got to be skinny and a model to be pretty, you know, like stuff like that. We could easily have a much better society. We focus more on our, like, girls and building them up instead of letting the world tear them down.
So, I mean,
beautiful and terrifying.
You arguably have created a little girl and raised her to fruition as an adult. Her name happens to be Alana. Like, did she go through all those changes too?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Like, I look, just like looking back, I found a bunch of pictures, found a bunch of old pictures from, like, when I was 19, first started doing drag. And it made me, reminded me of all these, like, early drag memories and stuff. And I'm like, I've improved. Like, I've become much more secure, much more stable in who I am as a performer and as a character. Like, the character has grown. Like, the Alana character is so grown and changed and morphed and become, like, I've kept it kind of age appropriate too. Cause I'm always had the fear of being Madonna. I don't want to be Madonna. I don't want to be like Madonna and Cher. I don't want to be like,
bitch, I'll be Madonna all day long. I love that crazy lady.
I just don't want to be a 60-year-old creepy plastic version of myself trying to be 30. You know, I just, no.
You'd rather Darcel your way down the path and be graceful in your age.
I would rather be honest and genuine with what the fuck I am, you know, like, it's falling apart, but it's still here, you know, that's what I want, you know. But no, it's like, I've also helped raise a lot of little girls, like other people's little girls. And
little girls, like we were talking about one of our friends whose little girl had a child yesterday, you said.
Had a little boy, like, yesterday. But, like, so, you know, like the best thing I ever heard was that one time Danielle, Shelley's daughter,
yeah,
told me one day on dinner,
and she just got hitched.
Yep. She's like, you know, Auntie Jean, you never lied to me about anything. You always told me the truth, and you were always honest with me about things. But you also never told me I was bad or that I did anything bad. Like, you always were, like, honest, but you were always kind to me. And I'm like, well, yeah, because, you know, young people need to be treated with kindness. and respect. You know, you're trying to turn them into adults. You don't want them to be like feeling like children forever, but you don't want them to like think that they're rotten either.
And you do have a definite skill in that, and maybe it's because you didn't get a lot of that in your youth, but my kid speaks nothing but gold of you, you know, like, oh, well, Gene,
you did a great job with yours. Like,
you know, accidental wins, accidental wins, you know, I did me and it seems to have worked out. I definitely had my falls. I have some not pretty moments, but like, because you've been so influential on so many of our children.
Well, I'm Auntie Jean. That's what I have to do.
Agreed. Well, you're good at it.
I like to thank musicals from the 50s and movies from the 50s and 60s for making me like a good auntie character, because yeah, I'm like, I've had so many people tell me recently, especially recently, like, so did you ever watch that Brady Bunch episode when that weird aunt that traveled around the world came to visit? I'm like, oh, I love those episodes. Like, yeah, you're like that weird aunt, or like that crazy, like black haired gal, that, like, in that movie, that Auntie movie that I'm like, Mame, like, yeah, you're like Auntie Mame. You're like really like eccentric and funny, but also really like nurturing and sweet. And then like when other people over here, they'd be calling me nurturing and sweet, they'd be like, really? You're nurturing and sweet? And I'm like, yes. They said so, didn't they?
Yes, bitch. But I mean, you are nurturing sweet in the same way that you just expressed that Daniela told you. It's like you don't tell kids that they're wrong. You remind them that it's okay to be different, and it's okay to express what they do and to feel the way that they do and be unapologetically who they are. And
I talked to my ex that I was with for 8 years, and he left, and there's a lot of anger and hatred in my part, you know, when you did that. But we've been separated for like 20 years almost now. And I was talking to him last night because he called to tell me that one of our friends had passed away. And so I was talking to him last night, and he's like, so I have to tell you something that I've told other people, like everybody that we mutually know. And I realized I've never told you. And I'm like thinking, oh my God, he's going to confess finally that he cheated on me, whatever, you know? And he's like, one of the best traits that you have is that you're always 100% you. You're unapologetically you. You've never been anybody else. You've never tried to be anything different than what you are. You're aware of like where you came from and what you suffered and what you've been through. But you're also aware that other people have gone through similar stuff, and maybe your lessons will help them. And he's like, and I've told people that was the best. That was the thing that made me fall in love with you in the first place, was that you were 100% you. You were unapologetically Gene and nobody else. And I'm like, okay. Thanks for making me cry.
This may not help that situation, but I mean, like we were talking earlier about how nobody has an inside cheerleader, you know? And it sounds like for a lot of these kids, our kids, the kids of our culture, you have to some extent become their inside cheerleader. Like a lot of these kids can't hear you going, rah, rah, rah. Yeah, hell fucking yeah, you can do it. And they hear it in Gene's voice. It sounds like you've done that.
Well, I just believe that, like, I think that's from my mom, like in her behavior towards me. But I think that, like, I made the decision to try and be the opposite of her. Like I've always tried my best to not let all that happened in my youth color the way that I treat other people.
Yeah. Well, like, all of us learn a lot about how to be by learning a lot about how not to be.
And I just think that, like, I honestly don't think, like, okay, so I'm a big like believer in, like, I don't like trophy culture. I don't like everybody gets a participation ribbon. But I believe that you need to lose to understand how good it is to win. I truly believe that. Yes. I believe that you have to come in second, third, fourth, fifth, 25th.
You have to feel shitty so you understand the difference between feeling shitty and feeling good.
Exactly, because you don't know. And if you're a kid that's just constantly being given the you know, congeniality prize or the participation prize, then you grow up thinking that you are just okay. Like, you're great. No, not everybody's great. Some people have to work to be great. Like, you have to work to be great. And when you work towards being great, you feel great. And so I'm like, I'm a big believer in like, no, don't give a bunch of participation trophies. You know, not everybody's the same. But I'm also a big believer in telling young people and even adults. I tell adults all the time. Like, I tell my clients, my middle-aged female clients, I'm always telling them, like, oh, honey, do you think maybe that's not a good thing to think about yourself? Or that oh, maybe your husband isn't – that's not nice. That's not fun. Like, you know, you need to be you. You need to live your life. But I also believe in telling children, like, when they do something good, tell them they did something good. And when they haven't done it yet, if they're working on something, tell them they can do it. Nothing worse than telling a kid that they look up to you, and the kids look up, even the bitchiest, meanest, nastiest teenagers and preteens that say they hate their parents, they hate adults, they still look up to adults and they still watch adults and how they work and how they behave and how they act. Lead by example, and don't be afraid to tell, like, that bitchy, angry, pissy teenager or preteen that, oh, you want to do that? Go for it. Do it. If you need more advice, let me know. If you need help, let me know. But I think you can do this. I think you can do this. Pretty sure you can do this. You've got this. It doesn't take any more time to tell a kid they got this and then tell them that they can't do it. You know, they don't know how to do it, or they're not good enough at doing it.
Like, yeah.
And I tell that to adults too. I'm like, I have no problem. Like, oh, somebody needs to be the cheerleader.
Well, it's Auntie Jean.
Rah, rah, ree, you know?
Kick him in the knee, honey. So the next question I got for you, my dear, is, will you tell me about a happy memory?
Oh, gosh. You know, I think one of my most happiest memories, the best one in the world, was when I was, it has to have been when I was a little kid. Like, I'm talking like maybe 5, 6. No, it had to be about 8. I was about 8. And we lived in, no, I was 7. We lived in West Flynn, my parents managed apartments. And, there was, if you went to the end of the apartment complex and went down this trail, this weird trail, like, we lived in Westland, in the middle of Westland, like, this is a city. This is, like, city, like, big city. This isn't a country town at all.
Yeah, it's a suburb of Portland, yeah.
Yeah, you went to the end of the apartment complex and you walked under this, like, fence, and there was trails. Because there was, like, 2 vacant lots between the back of the apartment complex and this other thing. And there's these trails running through this thing. And in the middle of the trails, you got to the very center of the trails, there was a giant tree that somebody, 1 billion years ago, built a tree for it in like a platform. Just like a bunch of plywood and planks, like platform, but you had to climb up like these horrible rungs of like rickety old rotten wood to get to it.
But you're young enough to like, fuck it, of course I'm going to do it.
Yeah,
no fear.
No problem. And me and my friend Scotty would, like, every day, every nice day when it wasn't, like, pouring down rain or snow, because he lived, like, if you went to the end of the apartment complex and you went through another, like, small vacant lot, his house was there. Like, he was, like, a lot away from the apartment complex where he lived. And we would climb that tree and hide up there and just laugh and talk. And about just done stuff. But I remember like summer days, like middle of summer, it's hot. You have all the time in the freaking world. You know, the sun's coming through the leaves and we're laying on dusty, nasty, rotten, slivery, beaten up planks of wood. And I think that was probably my happiest, like every one of those. Because when you're young, it's forever. Like, you have forever. And I miss that. I miss having forever. Like, once I got old enough to realize I didn't have forever anymore, that really, like, sucked, you know? Because it colors everything.
Yeah, the moment you realize that you are not permanent, it does change your outlook on everything. But I was curious because earlier you had mentioned some of your happier moments being when you're on a psychotropic of some sort, an entheogen. Oh, yeah. And that is another place where the concept of forever is different. Like, anybody who's ever done one can agree with this. I'm not saying horse shit. Like, anybody who's ever done one effectively knows the concept of forever is very different when you're in the head state. And it sounds like maybe those opportunities gave you a chance to go back to that feeling of this moment is out of place, out of time, can exist forever, and unfortunately doesn't, but you can grasp to it, and you can you get to that place still? Like, can you close your eyes and take yourself to that treehouse?
Oh, yeah. And certain things bring me back to that point. Like, so this summer, we're in lockdown and everything, but there's some really hot, hot days. And they replaced the back deck of my apartment.
Oh, nice.
And the guy was
cutting wood. It was getting a little rickety.
Oh, it was bad. I could see through to the downstairs deck. The apartment was pulling off. So they replaced it. And at the end of one of the days, it was really warm, and they just finished. And the guy who did it was cutting the wood down by his truck and then hauling it up and placing it and everything. I went to go get the mail, and I walked down the steps, and I smelled, like, the heat and the ozone and the wood shavings. And it reminded me of that. It just, like, zapped me back to that place, and I just felt so good for, like, better part of an hour, maybe. Mm. And just remembered how, like, cool it was to be a kid. An alone kid. Like, a kid not around their parents. And then I've got all these friends that, like, helicopter parent. And I'm like, you need to let your kids have kid time. You need to let them be alone. Like, trust me. They're not going to die if you don't watch them 24/7. Like, let them play in the backyard alone. Let them have friends over.
And for that matter, take their phone away when they do it.
Yeah, you know? Give them the
really alone.
Give them the concept that don't talk to weirdos and don't get in anybody's van, but, like, let them be kids and let them be their own person occasionally and make those memories, because you can't make memories all the time when you have your parent right on top of you, like, 24/7. Like,
yeah. That was one of the things I practiced a lot with my kid is allow him to run off into the world.
Gemini.
What's that?
When you guys were at Gemini party and you'd bring him to Gemini and he's like, there's
a, I just let him free. Like, here's a condom and some water. Go have fun.
If you get hungry, ask anybody, they'll feed you.
Yeah. And he was really good at that. He learned that his very first Gemini, he walked up, wait, this is Uncle Milty's meats and eats. That means there's food. Can I have some? And Milty sent him back, and he wasn't just, he found me and was like, Dad, can I have a plate? Milty says I need a plate. Here you go. Here's a plate. And off he went. And that kid eats better at a Gemini party or a festival than he does at Thanksgiving dinner with his family. He has that shit under control.
Yep. I used to love watching him, like, just him and the other kids just, like, go nuts. Like, just all, like, I used to get miffed, though, because I'm, like, kind of, like, a little bit of a taskmaster in a lot of ways. And so, like, sitting at a fire pit, and all of a sudden you see, like, you realize there's, like, two, like, 10-year-olds sitting there at the other side of the fire, and you're like, what time is it? And you're like, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. Why aren't you in your tent in bed?
Well, and with my kid who always got a pass at the red light district because I worked in the red light district, like, it's even more confusing. Why are you here? I'm Tyler's kid. Oh. Got it. Check.
That was a good thing. That's one thing I can say that really came out good from meeting Shelly was the fact that I got to go to Gemini party. And that taught me a lot about life. Like, I learned a lot of tolerance and humility by going to festivals. Like, And those were two of my, those still, oh guys, still have a real problem with the tenets of working tolerance and humility. Like I still, those are two lessons I still work hard on. But it helped me a lot going to festivals to learn that. Like, cause like I didn't have to taskmaster. I shouldn't have taskmaster. It's not my job. Like, kids are crazy. Kids are fun. They're having fun. They're safe. There's nobody out here going to hurt them. Let them do what they need to do.
Their parents have set them free. This is like a Boy and Girl Scout camp out, a co-ed camp out, and they get to go do themselves and figure out who they are and have their alone time and climb a goddamn tree or run through the fucking group of adults with tomahawks like the lost children they are. And yeah, that's how we learn to be festival people somehow. And we're just affording that to the to our children.
See, I didn't learn festival type stuff until my first year at Gemini. Mm. As already an adult. Before that, I didn't have any experiences like that. I like didn't have any wildling in the woods with a bunch of other wildling people, like just having a blast. And like that set my head for a loop. Like that changed who I was. And then going to Burning Man is even more so. Like that first year at Burning Man just blew my mind and made me realize that I could be anybody I want to be. And I can change anything about my world and my environment and my little microcosm bubble if I want. Like I have that power. And that blew me away. Like that changed me. Like I don't have to be stuck. I don't have to be what everybody thought I needed to be, you know?
I get to show up and wear whatever I want to because I think I look great in it. And this is my version of fabulous. And this is what I present. And everybody else is going to be accepting of it at that event. And yeah, there is a certain freedom that although I had opportunities to be in situations that were close to that, they weren't quite as free as the festival life. I have tailored back, like, I'm not a festival life kind of guy much anymore. Frankly, I embraced it a little bit too hard. It's for my own personal well-being that I don't do it, as we both know. I was really good at it.
You were really good. You were A++ good at it, like dangerously good at festivals. Yeah.
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 Yeah, so I've had to tailor that back a little bit, but I still cherish the experience. I'm going to press the pause button really quick because I need to. And so the next question, now that we're back from quick break, is, Gene, are you happy?
Sometimes. Like right now, I'm happy.
Thank you.
Like this last hour, I've been happy. Like, and generally, as a rule, I think I am happy, like, most of the time. And it's getting better. Like, every week it gets a little, like, easier to be happy. Thank goodness for, like, health insurance because it gave me a chance to get a doctor who actually listened and had a whole checklist of things for me to check off and get me an antidepressant and get me some mood stabilizers. And it was that was, like, 3 weeks ago, and I'm feeling I don't think about the bad things as much. I don't think about, like, death as much as I did, like, my whole life. Like, a few years back, I did confessions, and I was, like, once a week, I was confessing something on Facebook that about myself just to give people more of an insight into.
I remember those. Yeah, those were actually really touching, by the way.
And but they were true. Like, I honestly, like, one of the things that's always bothered me is that there hasn't been a day as early as I can remember that I didn't think about death. Like, not necessarily, like, wanting to act on it, but, like, think about throughout the day, think about, like, how I would do it and what would happen if I did it and what would have to be set up beforehand and all the plotting and planning of that. And that's, like, and I did that as a child. Like, how fucked up is that? There's a little kid when I should have been, like, blissfully, blindly happy all the time, like ignorantly happy, I wasn't. Like that's weird. And I don't think that's normal or right. And so, like, but it's been easier the last week. It's been easier to be happy and not think about those things as much. And I don't think about those things as much. And know, I've been finding more joy in things. And I found this workbook called Be Happy, Bitch. And it's literally like...
A sounds like it's workbook. Written for you.
It's great. And the woman lives in Salem. Like,
oh,
I haven't physically met her yet, but I ordered her book and I'm like, hey, I live in Salem too. And I'd like to I would really like to meet you at some point after I work through your book.
Yeah, totally reach out because the internet's a small place. That becomes a possibility. Yeah.
And I'm halfway through her workbook, and I'm going to message her when I finish it. I'm going to be like, hey, can I just meet you? Like, I just want to meet you. I want to meet you in a public place, and I want to, like, tell you what I thought or how your book helped me. Because already it's helped me. Like, and it's a great workbook. It literally is called Be Happy, Bitch. And it's pretty much all about, like, it was written from a woman's perspective about, like, life and everything. Like, there's exercises and... They're all geared to make you realize that you don't have to be unhappy. You don't have to be miserable. Like, there's nothing stopping you from being happy.
Other than yourself.
Other than yourself. Yeah, your own worst enemy. And, you know, it's like there's relationship advice in there. And there's, like, exercises, pro and con exercises. And, you know, things you do, like, taking a good hard look at your day or your week. And think, is this bringing me joy? Is this making me happy? Well, if it's not making me happy, why is it not making me happy? What can I do to change it? If I can't change it, then maybe I should stop doing it. Like, move on. Get something else. And I saw the title for my chair. I saw the title of the book. I'm like, be happy, bitch. Yes, that should be my new mantra. Be happy, bitch. Look myself in the mirror, mantra, but be happy, bitch. And I don't do that every morning, but I do try to, like, look at myself and be like, okay, there's a lot better. I'm a lot better than I have been in the past, you know? And I'm a lot more happy. I'm a lot happier on a regular basis than I was even years ago.
So you prescribe some of that to the new cocktail of chemicals they've given you, which do their trick. I mean, they have their space. But I also firmly believe that the change doesn't happen without you changing. What have you changed that has done that for you? Like, just you.
I've been trying not to be negative in any way if possible. Like, I've tried not to dwell on negativity or project negativity. Like, I wake up in the morning when the alarm goes off, even if I've only had 2 hours of sleep. I, like, wake up, and the first thought in my head is, after going potty, of course, the first thought in my head
is... Yes, we are no younger, honey.
I first thought in my head in the morning, I'd be like, wow, it's a different day. Like, A, I woke up, yeehaw, because I might not have I might die in my sleep, you know, but I didn't. I woke up, and I've got a whole, like, 17 to 18 hours of awake time that I control. And I remind myself, like, I have a post-it note in my bathroom mirror right now that says, remember, you have complete control over your future and your existence. And I have to remind myself of that because I forget that. And I let other people control it. Or I think that it has to be the same monotonous thing every day. And it doesn't have to be. Like, I had to put a freaking note on my mirror to remind me, like, while I'm brushing my teeth, that I have control over my future and my existence and my life. Nobody else, unless I give it to them, has that control. And I have to remind myself of that because I'm, like, forgetful of that. And that's not good. But remind myself of.
I like that you use, for lack of a better word, post-it note affirmations because I also do it. Like, I've got a post-it note here that I generally use to cover up the camera when I'm not doing one of these. Because I'm paranoid, sickoid.
You too, huh?
Oh, yeah, totally. Like, but I got to have something removable, so it's a post-it note. It used to be blue tape. but it's a post-it note, and for the last, I want to say, 6 years or so, every time I have to replace, because post-it notes wear out, especially when they're subjected to a warm computer monitor, it says, life need not be perfect. It need only be acceptable. And it's something I forget. Like, I make myself so unhappy by trying to make life fucking perfect all the goddamn time. And it's not going to be. Like, is it okay right now? yeah, well, shut the hell up and revel in that moment. And I just, I too am obviously a post-it note affirmation dude, which I never thought I'd be like. I had friends whose parents were in therapy and shit in the '80s, and they'd have post-it notes on their drive on their steering wheel and shit. And it's like, this is fucking crazy.
No. But if you repeat something enough, it's almost like a mantra or a prayer.
Yes.
If you see it enough, even if you're not, like, even if I'm not registering that post-it note is in my way, like on my mirror in the bathroom, if I'm not thinking about it, my peripheral, I feel that my peripheral vision sees it, my subconscious sees it, and it repeats it. And it says, hey, you got this. Like, you're in charge of your life, your existence. And I think that even when I don't focus on it, being there, read it, physically read it, somewhere in my head is reading it.
Like, yeah, I mean, your subconscious picks up on it. Your brain sees it all, whether you bring it in front of your vision or not. Yeah.
It's like when quarantine, I was like a month, the last month of lockdown, I realized I'd put on weight that I didn't need, like bad, because I was eating everything in sight.
Don't tell anybody what I've been doing, honey.
I put a post-it note on each shelf of my fridge, as well as one on the handle of the fridge, and taped it down that said, you're not hungry. That's all it said. You're not hungry.
You're just bored. How do you get a... All right, I need to do that to my fridge. How do you get a post-it note to stick in the fridge? Because I need to do that to my refrigerator.
Duct tape. Like, I had duct tape, like, to every shelf. So that when I reached in the fridge, like, I would see that one on the handle, but I'd ignore it. And then I'd reach into the fridge, and I'd be like, you're right, I'm not hungry. And I'd shut the fridge, and I'd go sit back down and do more crafts, you know, because I am definitely a boredom eater. I will yeah. devour whatever just because I'm bored. And it was like, so I've tried everything in the book that every self, like, dieter, help diet person tells you. I bought smaller blue plates because blue curbs your appetite, and small plates, you can't fill them up as fast. Don't eat the chips or the bag. Put them in a bowl. Take them to your wherever you're going. Don't eat them. You have to get up and go. And you're lazy. You're not going to get up and go back to the chips. I'm going to get up and go back to the chips because I'm lazy, but I'm not that lazy. I will refill that little bowl 40 times so I've eaten the whole fucking bag. Just, I, none of it works. Like, those are all stupid things for me. But telling myself via note that I'm not hungry helps.
Well, I also have
a note on my Brita, my big Brita in the fridge. The note says, have a glass of water before you eat anything. Yeah, I'll drink a glass of water. I only have the big freaking, like, 24-ounce pounder type glasses. So, like, fill one of those and guzzle that down, and then I'm not hungry anymore because I'm full of water. Yeah. Whatever it takes, I'll force myself, you know, to, like, do good in some way.
Like, I think your post-it notes speak to the part of your brain that still goes with the scarcity concept. Like, knowing what I do about your youth and the way a lot of us grew up, like, resources weren't as available. We weren't able to go get drippy, greased corn dogs at 3 a.m. or whatever. Yeah. And the fact that we have that luxury now, because we've worked for it and earned it ourselves, we just feel like we deserve it all the time. And we, that note speaks to that brain that goes, just because it used to be scarce doesn't mean it is now. And it doesn't mean that you need to overindulge in that world. And it is attacking your brain from a different place than all the diet books and all the buy blue plate bullshit and whatever it was. It's getting us at our core of it, that resource is not scarce. Stop.
Well, it works with so many other things, like that the concept of resource thing. Like, so I realized that I have, like, those totes that slide into the cubes, like the cube shaped, like, pull out drawer holder things for Minute Maid, but it's not, you know, like the closet people. So I have those, and I've got one of those that's full of socks, full, like, full.
You really don't need this many socks.
A folded up, rolled up socks, and another one that's full of underwear, and that's just the everyday underwear. That's not the weird, kinky, weird, freaky, fantasy bullshit underwear that I have. I have a whole nother bin full of those. Like, because I like underwear for some reason. And so like, I'm like, you know, where did this come from? Why do I have so much socks and underwear? Why do I have so many t-shirts? Why do I have 80 different t-shirts, short sleeve t-shirts? I have about 80 of them. Why do I have 80 of them?
Because when you were young, you had 3.
Yeah. Yep. Pretty much. I spent most of my teen years, because that was when things were really tight for our family, was when we moved to Walport. And I had to make things last. I didn't have a lot of things. And like, I truly believe it's never too late to have a happy childhood, explained by all the dolls in my life. You know, it's never too late to have a happy childhood. But I have that scarcity feel. I have that, like, that part of one of the reasons why I'm such a pack rat, I think, is because, like, I'm afraid to get rid of anything for fear that I'll never have it again.
Well, and that it's built further into that. When things are scarce, you keep everything because there may be a nut or bolt on that thing or a tiny little piece that you need to fix something else you really care about. And so, of course, I didn't throw the old VCR away. And
I tell everybody that comes to my house, I'm like, spend 45 minutes with me and you'll leave with a goodie bag. Everybody leaves a lovely parting gift from my home.
Because the goodie bag was so actually the stuff. Subtitle for the last episode. Narrowly dodged a goodie bag.
And then you end up getting a doll in exchange. Like,
oh, which I love him. I show him off all the time. He lives on my shelf over there of collectibles.
The picture I have of like you holding him, and I show it to people, they're like, fuck, man, that looks just like him. I'm like, uh-huh. Like, uh-huh. How insane is that? Like,
it makes me, in tune with the podcast, it makes me so immensely happy just to see him up in his gold box on my floating shelf there above my sofa, which is in the other room. So I can't really take my computer and turn you. But it just makes me so immensely happy. Yeah.
I still have been looking, and I keep my eye out because someday I'm going to find, like, really, really, really thin black leather.
Oh, dear.
And I decided when I find the really, really, really thin black leather or leatherette, I'm going to have to make him a leather butt outfit. Like, he's going to have, like, the leather pants and, like, find a duster and, like, a rubber hat. Like, just – it really needs to look like Festival You. Like, he needs an outfit that looks like Festival You so bad.
Yeah. Festival me. I mean, I look weird on the street in day-to-day life, but festival me? Whoa, buddy. it's my clown costume, if you will. It's where I get to be absolutely free to be me and me.
I have a friend who lives in New York who she saw the pictures when I posted them of different dolls that I've done. And I didn't post a picture of, like, your doll naked. But she's like, I love that.
That's a whole different thing.
She's like, that portrait doll you made is amazing. And I'm like, yeah, well, here, let me send you this because you're going to think this is hilarious. And so I sent her the picture of, like, the doll naked.
Of how kind you were? Yes. Yeah.
She goes, whoa. And I'm like, what do you mean, whoa? Don't you like, isn't that great? And she goes, that's great, but that's great. Is it like epic great? Yes, it is. And so then I turn around. So I bought this Gene Simmons, like, as the demon from Kiss.
Yeah.
Mega figure, like, reproduction for, like, dirt cheap around Christmas time. And then I realized I still had a bunch of that nude Fimo left. And I gave him a penis.
Oh, dear.
He didn't have one.
Well, no, so they don't make dolls with penises. Only my mother ever did that. My mother and you.
It's so funny. They gave me an erect one, and the costume for the demon from Kiss is, like, really low cut. And so the whole head of it sticks up, so I made it, like, big. I guess Gene Simmons is really big from what I heard. So,
well, to his credit, apparently there's, like, 1,000 or 2,000 women you could ask. So...
And I've been putting penises in every male doll I've made. Like,
since then.
It's bad. I've made 3 male dolls since then, and I have to give them dicks. I don't know why. Why they need to be genetically correct. I do not understand, like, what's in me that says they need that, but
well,
obviously they need that.
As I said, only 2 people in my life have ever made me anatomically correct male dolls. The first one was my mother. The second one was you. And, yeah, you did me better than God did, so I'll take it. Thanks, honey.
Well, see, in my head, that's what you're packing. So, like...
You know, I'm running around with a big dick energy.
Yeah. Yeah, when you're at festivals, you definitely are. Like, I remember, like, one of the first experiences I had with you at a festival was, like, you had the electric machine.
Uh-huh. And was it when it was wired up to my bar, or was I still running around with it in my hand?
You were running around with it, and you're like, you came over to me and Shelly, and you're like, and she, like, you leaned down and, like, give her a kiss, and she went, oh. And I'm like, what? Are you that good of a kisser? And so I was like, you should try that. And you just, like, leaned over and said, put your hand here. And like, we did it. And I'm like, whoa, that was interesting. I never had anybody, like, kiss me with an electric current running through me. Like, that was awesome.
Well,
like, that was awesome.
Yeah, that doesn't happen every day.
and it never happened before, and it never happened since. It was so bizarre. Like, it was like, and that's the day that was the first time that I, like, really was like, I like him. Because, like, I like him. Yeah, it was so unexpected and so different. And that's what set my whole headset. That experience set my whole headset for festivals. Was you set my headset for festivals after that, because I'm like, expect anything to happen. Anything can happen. Anything.
Well, and if somebody runs up and says, hey, trust me, try this, and they look trustworthy.
Well, see, I found out I have a real skewed view of trust. Like,
yeah.
So 2 summers ago, I get out of the hospital and everything, and I had like 3 months good, and I was on my way to work, and I had my bag and everything. I'm standing at the bus stop, and a car stops and pulls up in front of the bus stop, and the window rolls down. I don't recognize either people. There's a black woman in the seat and passenger side, and there's this guy with like a blonde undercut and sunglasses, and the guy goes, you heading to work? And I'm like, yes, I am. And the gal goes, get in, and unlocks the back door. So I throw my bag in. I pop into the car. We're driving. We're at like 3 blocks down the road, too fast for me to jump out. I'm not even thinking about that. And the guy goes, you don't know who we are, do you? And I'm like, no, I don't. But you knew I was on my way to work. And then I realized I just hopped in the car with strangers. Like, I don't know these people. And I hopped in their car with my bag and let them drive me down the road. Like,
all right. And then, well, like, and you keep your living in your bag. All your scissors and everything are in your bag, right?
No, they weren't. Like, everything was at work. You know, like,
oh.
And so I'm like, okay, I'm already in the car. I'm going to die or get raped or something. Maybe I'll enjoy it. Who knows? We'll see. And then it was like the guy took off the sunglasses. It was my friend Aaron. And I didn't realize that he'd got a whole hairpiece done because he was bald as an onion. So I didn't recognize him. I didn't recognize the car. I didn't recognize him with sunglasses on and with a full head of hair. But he's like, this is unsafe, Gene. You climbed into the car with strangers. We could have done anything we wanted to you. You could have been killed. We could have kidnapped you and killed you. Killed you. Chopped up in pieces. No one would have found you. I'm like, but you didn't. And like, that's not the point that it didn't happen. You got me in the car with strangers. That's unsafe. I'm like, oh, but God, you're right. That's really unsafe. I did it again recently.
Gene.
I was leaving the liquor store at the end of my street, and this car pulls up.
It is. All right. I know where the liquor store in relationship to your house is.
Yeah.
Don't get in a vehicle. Walk the 2 blocks, fucker.
And the guy goes, it started to sprinkle and rain. And the guy goes, hey, it started to rain. Gene, get in. And I'm like, okay. And I jump in and I put the seatbelt on and close the door. And I'm like, I don't know you. And he starts driving. He goes, no, you don't. So my name's Craig. I live at the end of your street. I've seen you a bunch. I know your niece. She told me you were a hairdresser. I'm going to school for barbering. And I've been waiting to see you so I can pick your brain and meet you and find out. And I'm like, oh, okay. So we chatted. Now we're best friends. Like, we're buddies. Like, but I climbed in the car with a strange, straight man.
You can't live on that. You can't live on that grace of God forever.
Like, no, I can't. But I have a real problem with like knowing what's safe and what's not. I guess I look like
you need more of your adulting people around,
or just maybe to learn to like not get in the car with strangers. That's why I tell every little kid, don't get in the car.
Just don't go anywhere without a Jiminy Cricket, man.
I've given children advice. Do not talk to strange people you don't know. And I was telling my dad about this, like, when I was down with him, and he's like, yes, yeah, but you were always that kid. I'm like, what do you mean? And he goes, we tried to warn you about strangers and don't talk to people you don't know or you don't recognize. But you would look at us like we were insane when you'd say that. And then you'd, like, talk to the nearest person you've never met in your life. Then usually the creepy person, Gene, you'd always go up to, like, the creepy, flasher-looking, child molester person. And you'd walk up to them and be like, my name's Dean Dewart, and I live in Oregon City. And they'd introduce themselves, and you're like, we're friends now. I still do that.
There's a very respectable innocence in that, though. Like, it is...
It's ridiculous.
But it's a purity of soul. Like, it's kind of...
I'm a 48-year-old man who, like, never met a stranger.
Exactly. Never met a stranger is words that an ex of mine's parents used to use. Like, or an ex of mine used to use about her parents. Is that her mom never met a stranger, and just everybody was not stranger. And like I said, there's a respectful innocence in that. The belief somewhere inside that people are just wholeheartedly good, and you just act that way without, when you don't think about it. When you think about it, you're able to bring in, not everybody's great, but when you don't think about it, you're like, fuck yeah, everybody's great. And man, it is a youthful view that I think the world would benefit more of us having. I do fear for you, though.
Well, I fear for me, too, and I look back on it. I'm like, what the hell, Gene? Like, really? Like, you could have been chopped up and in the back of somebody's trunk without knowing it. Like, there's sick people out there. I watch the news occasionally, and I see those shows.
Right.
One of my favorite people on YouTube is Bailey Sarian, and she does Makeup and Murder Mondays. Like, she does her makeup and talks about, like, some sort of murder case that's on her mind at the moment.
I don't know that I've seen her, but I've seen those ladies, because it's a thing. For some reason, women really love true crime and abduction stories. And makeup tutorials. And if you can combine the two, you can be an internet sensation.
It's heaven if you can combine them.
Yeah.
I love makeup tutorials, and my favorite show in the world has always been any one of those murder shows that deals with, like, women. Because I love women murderers and women serial killers. Like, because there's no such thing as a woman serial killer.
Oh, yes, there is.
Because women are so – they kill out of passion, anger, or emotion. Like, men kill because they're nuts. But, like, all these women that are, like, they all have a purpose. There's a reason why they're killing. Like, the nurses that kill babies, like, they're killing for a reason.
The first verifiable woman to be defined as a serial killer was Eileen Wuornos.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, she wasn't a woman. She's a man.
Oh, interesting argument.
Like, I think that she was honestly, like, her energy was masculine energy, like,
very much. And, like, if you see videos of her, it very much is a masculine energy.
I don't know what I did here. Oh, God.
But I can hear you.
I don't know what I did. I bumped something.
You touched a button. It's going to be fine. while you figured out, it is like Eileen Wuornos is the first woman to be defined as a serial killer, to the best of my knowledge. Possibly Lizzie Borden, but that was more familicide. She killed her family as opposed to Eileen Wuornos, who just indiscriminately killed.
And honestly, who hasn't thought about that?
My guess is healthy people. I don't know. I don't have an answer.
So, like, you know, when I was a little kid growing up, and I learned the Lizzie Borden, you know, song, and
yep.
You know, I used to say that in my head a lot when I was a kid.
And, gave her father 40 wax and gave her mother 48 more or something like that. Yeah, whatever it was.
See that? I could have done that to my mom a couple times. Like, I wouldn't have hurt my feelings. Like, I thought about it, you know. But I was always a wimpy kid with no upper body strength. I still don't have any, so I couldn't swing an axe that many times. Lizzie Borden had to be buff to do it. Like, if she really did it, she had to be insanely burly to do that.
Well, for what it's worth, I don't know if you've seen the new, I think it's called the Borden Diaries or something like that. But Christina Ricci played Lizzie Borden, and it was fucking amazing.
Oh, I bet.
Oh my God.
Like, that's really like us making somebody prettier than they really were. Like,
yeah, it is very much of that.
Over the top.
Like Lizzie, like when you look at actual pictures of Lizzie, she was not going to get married off anytime soon.
No. She was an outdoorsy looking lass.
Yeah. All right. We're in the weeds again. So I'm going to bring you back to the last question.
Okay.
It's the last one. You made it.
Yay.
Not that conversation has been difficult at all. The last question, Gene, is what makes you happy?
Oh. Toys. Like, I know that sounds really horrible to say, like, rough about it. It's the most selfish childlike thing to say, but, like.
Just so 80s.
Buying, like, so my thing is, like, what makes me really happy, like, the one thing that brings me the most joy in my life, besides masturbation, is toys. Like, I love buying a new toy. Anything. Like, I love getting a new doll or a new collectible or a new, like, Lego Mega Block set. I love that. And when I get it at the store, I will, like, I practically skip home. Like, I float on clouds getting home. And all I can think about doing is putting the rest of the groceries away and opening that up and examining it and posing it or building it or whatever. Like, that gives me such insane joy. Like, that brings me so much happiness. And then I guess second in line would have to be like the whole, I love when I can show somebody up.
Mm.
If that makes sense. Like,
that's a good deep pleasure.
A horrible, that's a dark side of me. That's like, I love when, so for a while at the shows, and it's always the shows that have this, that brings that out of me, is I'll get kind of lazy and I'll bring my B game to the shows a couple times in a row. And then I'll realize I'm doing it. And so then I'll find brand new numbers and costumes that are so away from like that whole spectrum that I was doing before that it makes every other queen look bad at the show. Like, I will pull a brand new Alana out of my ass randomly.
Yeah, but and everybody likes being the belle of the ball, honey.
But no, I deliberately do it to piss the girls off. I love making them jealous. I love making them angry with me because I did something amazing. Like,
so it's actually the vindictive pleasure of it.
It is. That's where the dark side of me. That's the evil little like demon that lives inside me is it gets off like extra happiness, joy from like showing somebody up. Like just being like, you know, haha, look who's better than you. You know, like I don't ever say it, but I act it. You know, like I would never look at one of the other girls and be like, so your numbers kind of sucked tonight. Glad mine didn't. At least I held the show.
You know, like,
that's awful. That's mean girl awful. That is like Regina George awful. But I do get a little sick jolly out of like showing up other drag queens. Like I love it. I love it. Like I love it. Like
so that's brought out a lot in what I'm going to consider myself the public and pretend I don't know you. The public gets to see the RuPaul's Drag Race or the whatever, right? Or the the whatever brothers one. Which was really weird.
Play Brothers, the Dracula.
Very weird. Super garbage. Yeah. Totally watched all of it. But that feeling or that sensation of outdoing your compatriots is brought out in those. And does it exist to that extent in your version of the real world?
It's so funny because so we've had people that competed on those shows come through and perform at our shows. In the past. And all of them said the same thing. They're like, you guys are so nice and so helpful. Like, you guys are so kind to each other and to people coming in. And I've performed all over the West Coast, you know, and like, yeah, like, amazingly enough, Salem is a very tight-knit drag family. Like, we help each other. Like, I could hate a bitch. Like, there have been bitches that have lived here that have performed that I hated. I hated their guts or the passion. Like, I would rip their heart out and eat it just so everybody could see how much I hated them. Like, if I could. But if that bitch needed, if her dress is ever blue, or if she needed safety pins, or if she needed fix before she went on stage, I would do it. Because that's what you do. In my book, and most of the queens here, they're like, that's our book. Like, you look out for each other. Like, I'm allowed to pick on you, and I'm allowed to tell people you're an evil, rotten cunt. But nobody else better tell me that you're an evil, rotten cunt, because I will defend you to the nth degree, saying, no, you are not. They are not the monster you think they are. Because it's like family, you know? Nobody's allowed to talk smack about my family but me, you know? It's like, but, yeah. No, there is a lot of competition, though. There's a lot of competition. Like, so when there's been times with Riri, that's the funny thing is, like, so for a while I was part of the show, the Escapade show, and the girls, besides Riri, the other three girls were like so thin, so pretty, so young. And they could do all this fancy shit like death drops and all that crap. I can't do a death drop. I would die if I did a death drop. Because I have an old, beat up, like, body.
I can't kneel on the floor and get back up in less than a minute and a half. That's just the way it is.
I don't get down on the floor because I can't get back up. Like, and so, like, they were great. Well, I started feeling like I was losing my grip on being all the Alana that I could be. So I started, like, I upped my game and I brought out some numbers I'd been working on for a while and some costumes and, like, showed all of them up. Like, my lovely friend Riri, who thinks that she's pretty convinced that she's the best in the world, I like to bring her down a peg or two every now and then by being better than her at her own show. Like, it's a subtle form of, like, hobbling, I guess. Like, it's just, like, it's just that little bit of, like, no, you're good, but you're not the best. And you get a participation ribbon this time, honey. Yeah, and I feel a little, there's a little part of me that feels a little guilty for doing it, but not that guilty because I still plot it and plan it and figure it out and then do it, you know.
Well, and
10% guilt.
Well, okay. Guilt aside.
Sees that. Like, the audience doesn't see this side of it. They just see a great performance.
And that's what, in my seat, that's what I see, yes.
My goal at the start of every show is to make every audience member see a good show. And, like, so I've noticed, I've watched girls take tips. Biggest pet peeve with me is just grabbing money out of people's hands. And either, like, oh, your hands are full of money. So instead of, like, tucking it somewhere, you toss it out of the way. Like, I feel that that says you don't care about it or about the person giving you the tip. I figure every dollar that person hands me, somebody hands me, that's a dollar. That's, like, that's a dollar of their money. They earned that money. And they're giving me that money because they think that I'm doing good. Or they like me, or they appreciate it. So I make sure that I make eye contact with every person that hands me a tip.
Yeah, at least the graceful nod or something. You. Yeah, the acknowledgement. Yeah, I will not
thank you or give them a squeeze. Like, I want them, every person in that audience, to feel special for being there. And every time I put on a show that I put on, I'd be like, that's the first thing I thank. Like, I thank the cast, and I thank the bar, and then I'd be like, and I want all of you to give a big, huge round of applause and pat yourselves on the back. Because without you, we wouldn't be here. Without the audience, there wouldn't be any drag show. So thank you all for coming, and you guys are amazing. And that's always ended it. It's like, the audience is important. Without the audience, it would be five drag queens doing circle rotations, tipping each other with the same $5 bill, you know? So the audience has to feel important. And I've had people come up to me and be like, you made me feel so special when you, like, I tipped you and you took that tip and you said thank you and you hugged me. And in my head, I'm like, I don't remember hugging you. I don't remember thanking you, but thank you, you know. And I'm like, well, you are special, or you are wonderful. Like, please come back and see us again. We're beautiful and fantastic. And I see a lot of drag queens that don't do that. I'm like, But I'm the crazy comedy queen, so I don't get to give advice.
Well,
when I give it, just look at me and blink like I'm like,
I would argue that A, you're not new at this, and B, you do get to give advice because it's helpful advice, and it goes beyond just the drag world. It is like my kid's mother was a dancer, And there were dancers that weren't thankful, and there were those that were.
Well, I always tip a thankful dancer.
Yeah, and the same thing from my service industry life, where as a worker in a restaurant, there are thankful customers, and there are those who are not as gracious, and or those recipients that are thankful and not as gracious. And it always seemed more important to be grateful. When, you know, for instance, there was one weekend when a couple, they were regulars, they owned a restaurant near town. They would come in near closing, and so I'd open up extra booths for them or extra space for them, whatever. And it was near Christmas. They left me $100 buried in a stack of like 21s, $100 bill buried in the middle of it. And the way that they'd done it and the way they tipped in the past, I knew they did it on purpose. But expressing my gratitude the next time I saw them, slightly after the new year, well, at least acknowledge, like, I got that. Thank you. Thank you for doing that for me. It made a difference. I appreciate it. And you have the grace to do that with your clientele, I guess, if you will.
Well, I do it. I do it in my hair business. Like, I've had clients that, because they know how hard it was this last like 5 months for me and everything. I've had quite a few clients like, and it blows me away. I put clients that I know they don't make a fortune. They're not rich, but they've got them in for their haircut, and their haircut's $15 and they've had me $40. And I'm like, oh, that's a lot more than the haircut. And they're like, yeah, take it. What? Like, thank you. That's so sweet. I had one gal that, I only see her once every like 2 months. And she paid me for her haircut because she was in visiting her parents, Salem. And she wanted a haircut. I squeezed her in. And she gave me $100. Like, gave me $100 bill. And I go, I can't cash this. You're going to have to go down the street and hope they can cash it. And she goes, I don't want change. And I'm like, but honey, that's insane. Like, thank you. That's sweet. That's helpful. But I know that you don't make a fortune. And like, really? And she's like, yes, really, take it. I love you. I'll see you in a couple months when I come back to visit my parents again. I'm like, okay, now I'm going to cry for a while. And she goes, good, do it now because I'm not going to be here to see it. And she turned around and walked out and waved behind her back and left. And I'm like always blown away by the kindness of people. But
well, I think that's coming out.
All of that, you know.
Not to be totally optimistic about our current place and point in time, but I think that's coming out a little bit more right now, is that we are realizing that our brothers and sisters, for lack of a different word, are sometimes struggling, and their life prospects may be squashed by what we're all working with right now. And it goes back to you leaving a big tip in a plastic bag underneath your doormat for the pizza person or whatever. Like, my delivery tips have gone up in number. Like, they're more than they used to be because I appreciate that service more, and I know that they need that more because they have fewer opportunities. And like, they're delivery driving right now because they can't wait tables. Or whatever. And if I was finding some light in this world that we live in right now, it's some of that. It's this deeper respect for one another that, again, through all the strife, all the hatred, all the divisiveness that's going on, we are kind of in some way getting in touch with what you do matters. And let me at least tell you thank you. Sometimes monetarily for what you do.
I think that's a big part of, like, I've noticed people being happier. Like, back to the happiness thing, I think people are being happier because they're being able to help people. Like, all the fires when they hit, like, I was so stunned every time I'd see the Portland Reddit or the Salem Reddit, and it would be like, hey, me and my husband both have our trucks at blank and blank spot. Call us if you need, we've got our animal haulers with us. Call us if you need.
I've got an extra room and a truck with a trailer hitch. Let's get your shit out and you have a place to stay. Those kind of comments.
I was totally safe. I was totally safe where I was, but I had three different people message me saying, hey, if they evacuate, I'm paying attention for your neighborhood too. If they evacuate your neighborhood, we're coming and getting you. And I'm like, thank you. Like one of my clients, she's just a client. Like we're not really close, even though we live close to each other. Like she lives like three blocks away. And she told me that she was talking to her husband and she goes, so I was talking with my husband and he said that, and I've never met her husband. And he said that if they evacuate the neighborhood, we're coming and getting you and you're staying in wherever motel or hotel we stay at. And I'm like, really? Like, he doesn't even know me. Like, your husband, your kids don't know me. I've only done your hair twice. You're offering to, like, save me when you save yourselves. And she goes, because you're a wonderful person, we like you. Like, I would hate to think that you had to walk with all your possessions, your important possessions on your back out of, like, your neighborhood to be safe. Like, no, we would get you. I'm like, oh, my God. Like, that's the most sweet, wonderful, kind thing I can think of. And I saw this from a lot of people, not just to me, but to other people. Like, it was amazing to see the amount of, like, help and love and kindness and generosity coming to other people that had lost their house. Like, there's whole towns that are gone. Detroit's gone. Like,
yeah, it's weird to me. One of my favorite towns, Blue River, is gone. Yeah.
Whole towns are just no longer there.
Brighton Bush is gone.
Brighton Bush, though.
They did an excellent job.
All of them, they saved the lodge.
They did save the lodge, but all the out cabins and my memories in those out cabins, some of them probably should have been burned, frankly. But not under these circumstances, please.
That was where Snarpy, the owner of the salon, took us for a Christmas gift. Was in January. They paid for the whole day at Brighton Bush for all of us, for the salon. And a whole day access to all the springs and lunch. And that was so amazing because I'd never been there.
Oh.
It was wonderful. And lunch was amazing. And I got a hand job in the sauna. And That was the last time somebody touched me down there that wasn't a medical professional. Like, and then I had to like wait for everything to go down so I could leave the sauna and like find my coworkers. And I wasn't a nudist. I wore swim trunks that whole day. Like, I'm like, nobody's seen that. And one person that saw that, he kind of liked it, I guess. But no, it's so weird. And it was such a magical, wonderful place. I'm like, I want to come back here for a weekend and stay in the lodge. And it was a guy who was on a silent retreat. Like, there was a retreat going on at the same time that we were there.
Retreats are weird.
They didn't talk.
Yeah,
they didn't talk.
Yep.
But I kept seeing this guy, like, earlier in the day I saw him. And I'm like, he's beautiful. Like, there was this thing about him that made me just, like, stunned. Like, I'm in the middle of talking to the girls, and I see this guy walk by. I'm like, and it just like some connection. And then when he saw me, when he was coming back from the breakfast, like, he's like coming out of the room, and like, I just instinctively turned when he came out the door because I could just sense him. I am a predator. I know it now. I'm a velociraptor. I'm just like. But yeah, he came out and he saw me and made eye contact and I smiled and nodded and he smiled and nodded. And then like later that day, we're like sitting side by side in the empty sauna. And yeah, we kept looking at each other like.
And it became more and more Turkish bath all of a sudden.
Yep. He reached out and put his hand on my thigh and leaned in and I looked horrified, I guess, because I must look terrified because he looked a little apprehensive. My eyes are big, and I'm like, and then he leaned forward, and I leaned forward. We kissed, and then before I know it, there was a hand job going on, mutual hand jobs and kissing. And you're the only person I confess this to because I haven't told any of my coworkers. So I'm like, they don't need to know what I did. They don't need to know my shame, my sluttiness.
It's on the internet now.
Yeah. Well, I told Snarky, like, we're on the way home, and so, like, the way up there was Red with Snarky and another coworker, and the other coworker has a OnlyFans, and she's very open about that. She's polyamorous and got a boyfriend and a husband. She's very open about these things. So I mentioned it to her in Snarky, because Snarky is a pervert like I am, and they're both like, oh. But I only told Snarky and the other girl that we just, like, hand-jobbed. Because Snarky wants to make out with me, and I keep, like, saying no. Because I can't do that. You don't make out with your coworker.
Yeah, keep the dick out of the office is always good advice.
Strangers in saunas.
Totally okay. Sticking your dick in a coworker, bad plan.
He wasn't going to go tell anybody at least that weekend because, like, silence.
So... my friend, I'm going to, at this point, tell you thank you very much for doing this with me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you. Sorry, once again, I could not keep the time down because I'm...
We're good. People love these longer episodes. I'm just going to press the stop button and say thank you very much. I will still be on screen with you when I press stop, okay. Just so you know, okay?
Well, you're very welcome.